Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Karen Landau, and I represent Appellant Ray Turner, who was the man who worked for the phone company. I will be addressing the identity fraud counts and the relationship between the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act counts. And then I believe Mr. Buell will follow me, and then Mr. Hummel in the first group. So with that.
Counsel, the government has helpfully put letters on each of these arguments. Have you all adopted those as well? Or?
I'm afraid I haven't.
Oh, well. All right.
Since the time of the trial in this case, there has been a sea change in the law that makes it clear that there is both insufficient evidence to support the computer fraud counts and also that the jury instructions were plainly erroneous. Because the computer fraud counts fall, Mr. Christensen's convictions must be vacated on all counts. The computer fraud counts were the basis for identity theft as to Mr. Turner and as to the other defendants. And the identity theft counts, were the only predicates for the RICO. So if those counts fall, then the RICO conviction must be vacated. And as I'll discuss at the end if I have time, there was prejudicial spillover as to the RICO conspiracy.
Let me see if I understand. I understand the argument, or I think I know the argument that's coming. I've read the papers with regard to the computer fraud claim. And there has been a change in the law there. I'm not sure that it's so clear that that change in the law affects all of the other convictions.
Well, then let's address the identity theft first, because it sort of hinges on that. Okay. The basis for the federal identity theft statute requires the transfer of a means of identification in connection with another felony, a violation of a federal statute or a felony under state law. And in this case, the identity theft counts had two underlying predicates. One was the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and the other was the violation of California Penal Code Section 502C2. The jury instructions on computer fraud were plainly erroneous because, as is fully discussed in the briefs, it essentially defined access as based on what was done with the information once it was obtained. And the information, when one reads the closing arguments, it's quite clear that that was the basis for the theory of guilt as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the basis for guilt on identity theft. That is a legally invalid theory. The jury, we don't know, and certainly the closing arguments suggest that the jury relied on that legally invalid theory to convict my client and probably the other clients.
I accept the proposition that it's a legally invalid theory for the federal statute. What makes it legally invalid for the state statute?
Well, it doesn't have to, for one thing. The fundamental point is when we have a legally invalid theory, the remedy is reversal unless you can tell that the jury returns its verdict.
Well, would the facts be any different? I mean, it could be argued that under Nassau the federal statute's been narrowed, but that doesn't affect the state statute. And if the facts are the same, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is, importantly, that, first of all, it is error under the state statute. To the extent that it was based on the state statute, the state statute also uses the term access. We don't have...
LaSalle doesn't bind the state of California.
No, it does not. But we also don't have a conclusive interpretation of that statute. But what we do have indicates very strongly that it's going to be interpreted similar and in the same way as the federal statute. And the two primary cases on that are Chrisman and also Hawkins, which talk about essentially refer to the statute it requires access, which is defined narrowly in the statute itself as requiring access to the logical, arithmetic, and something else functions. I'm sorry, my memory fails me. But when you look at there's a case, People versus Hawkins, where a defendant was convicted for violating 502C2, I believe, or one of the related subdivisions, on the basis that what he did is he went to a public library and he hacked into the back end, essentially, of the computer and was able to do things that he wasn't supposed to do. They found that constituted access because he hacked into the back end. And similarly, in Chrisman, It also involved the police officer who was using his device for, I forget what it was. He was using it for some activity that was not appropriate, and they found that that didn't constitute, because he had access to the system anyway, it didn't constitute access. So I think the case law, and the government has pointed out that there are some unpublished cases that have dictum that adopt a broad, you know, I mean, I won't deny they're out there. They adopt a broad interpretation. But I would say that the published authorities strongly suggest that that we have to this date that the California statute is going to be interpreted similarly. And the fact of the matter is that we still have the invalid theory on the CFAA. And I don't think that you can say for sure which the jury found. I mean, in a sense, the 502, as often in RICO cases, the state statute is charged as an afterthought. And it's quite clear, in this case, for example, one of the things that
unless the state statute is interpreted narrowly, as you argue, how do the facts of this stop match up pretty clearly to the state statute? I mean, I didn't read the state statute as being capable of not applying to this case if it's read as broadly as the federal statute had been before in the South, for
example. If it's read broadly, it would apply. But I don't think that that's a proper basis. I don't think you can uphold the conviction here when you have a legally invalid theory on the primary basis for conviction, as in this case, and that is what you have. And when
you're on a plain air standard, so you're going to have to demonstrate prejudice.
And I think I have.
Where's the prejudice?
In
fact, it would fit under the California statute.
Maybe. It might fit under the California statute, which is a wobbler, which, you know, yes, it can be construed as a felony, but it's also a misdemeanor. I mean, what you have here is such a tremendous amount of bootstrapping. You're basing a RICO conviction on a California statute that arguably was not properly interpreted at trial, and you're upholding a RICO conviction based on something that is largely charged as a misdemeanor. The fact it can be charged as a felony does not undo the prejudice here. I mean,
does the RICO conviction stand entirely upon the identity theft?
In my client's case, it does, entirely. The only predicate acts charged against my client are identity theft. If there are no further questions, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Gruhl. I'm the attorney representing Anthony Pelicano in this case. And I would like to save 2 minutes, if I may, for rebuttal. Mr. Pelicano, gentlemen, has been in custody since November 2003 on this case or this investigation. And he has served all of his time and 30 months on all the substantive convictions in this case. And as a consequence, the only thing that stands between him and freedom at this stage is the RICO conviction. And if I may, I'd like to address why that RICO conviction cannot be sustained in this case. Much as my colleague was talking about the predicate acts as they pertain to the computer fraud statute, which has been dealt with by Nozzle, the two other type of predicate crimes that the government used in essence to contort this information gathering case into a RICO case, because this case really involved wiretapping. And I would remind the Court that wiretapping is not a RICO predicate. And as a consequence, the government took great strains to contort other aspects of the law into RICO predicates, which, with the passage of time, much like Nozzle, those predicates cannot stand. The first that I would like to address is state bribery. And under state law, Section 67 and 68, something is needed much more than just a police officer accessing a database, whether it's Mr. Arneson or Craig Stevens, the other officer in this case, or those two individuals. Something else is needed, and that is that the access or the payment has to be made to influence an official conduct or official act by the particular police officer.
So how is accessing a database on a police computer not an official act?
It's not it is an access to a resource, Your Honor, and it is something that someone does as a police officer in a day-to-day duty, part of his duty, much like driving a police car or much like using his computer for whatever purpose. But I would submit that official act requires something discretionary and something where...
Nobody made him do it. He chose to do it. That sounds pretty discretionary.
No, but that's much like if he was going to give a ride for somebody for $50. That's not bribery. That may be some sort of crime or some sort of violation of official duty.
He used a police car, it might be.
That's a misuse of a resource, I would respectfully submit.
Somebody might want to show up in a police car looking like I've got power, so I'll give you $50 to take me to this place.
But I think the issue turns on the intent of both the payer and the payee, the officer, and that it requires something more under the California statute than just saying, here's $50, please access the car or the computer database.
What more is required?
Pardon me, sir?
What more is required?
An action that where you are requiring the officer to make a decision on some sort of official matter that is before him. For example, if he has arrested, and the case law that we cite in our reply brief talks about this, if an officer is there to arrest someone and someone says, here's $50, don't arrest me. That's clearly a bribery where you're telling that officer not to execute his duty of performing that arrest warrant. Or something in other contexts, if you're saying to a legislator, here's $50, I want you to address or vote on a particular matter in a certain way.
What would be the matter that was pending before
The officer?
The officer in this case.
There were no matters pending before the officers. The sole reason why Mr. Pelicano asked either Officer Stevens or Officer Arneson was to just gather information, access a resource, and just take that resource and provide it to him. Neither officer had to make any independent judgment, any independent discretionary decision, nothing whatsoever. It was nothing more than just providing the information that was on their databases. Now, moving on, if I may, to the other line of predicate acts, and that deals with Skilling. And with the passage of time, as I mentioned, as with Nozzle, we had Skilling come down. So the government, in one of its series of predicate acts, dealt with the honest service fraud. And as we know now with Skilling, that honest services is limited in scope to just bribery and kickbacks. It cannot be the full force of what the government argued before the jury and what the judge instructed at the jury of being a whole wide scope of many things.
Why doesn't the honest services in this context, given that the state statute talks about bribery, why doesn't that avoid the Skilling problem?
Because Skilling, Your Honor, requires, just as the state bribery requires a payment by a individual for an officer to exercise discretion on an official matter or official matter before him and make a decision that influences him, or the payment has to influence him. Bribery still requires that kind of quid pro quo, much like this court talked about in the Garrido case just a few months ago in this year, where it overturned some honest services convictions because there was no quid pro quo in that particular case.
Well, here there's a quid pro quo. There's money and there's something given in exchange for the money. I take it you're really making the same argument you just made, which is that what's given has to be this discretionary decision in an official capacity, not the access to the database.
Indeed.
And do you doubt that there's a quid pro quo here? There is a trade. Money goes one way, information goes the other.
That's correct. But the evil, if you will, that bribery tries to address is not the access to information that Your Honor just described, but using that discretion or the bribery to actually influence someone to make a decision on a matter pending before them.
Well, that's just a repeat of the Section 68 argument.
And to a great extent.
If you lose on 68, then you lose on the Skilling, wouldn't you?
Well, 67 only applies to my client,
67,
Your Honor.
67, right.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, but if I may, in Skilling, it did give some guidance as to what would constitute bribery under the honest services definition. And two of the cases that I cite in the reply brief are First Circuit cases, one being dealing with a IRS agent who accessed the private database that he had official access to. He accessed it, he provided the information, but there was the honest service conviction in that particular matter was overturned because there was nothing in that matter and his actions where he made any discretionary decision whatsoever under his official role as an IRS agent. He just provided information. The other First Circuit case cited in the reply brief is where a state senator was convicted because a hospital had paid him to have him introduce some individuals to him. That was not a violation of the honest service section under Skilling because there was nothing untoward or nefarious or that influenced the senator's decision to have these two entities meet. Nothing was done improper. That's the distinction, whether it's 67, Your Honor, or whether it's Skilling. It requires an official conduct, official action by the payee and the payor that there will be an influence by that individual on a matter that is before them, whether an officer, a senator, or any other type of government individual.
You're now down to a minute and change. Do you want to keep it?
No, I'll stop unless there's a question that anyone has. Thank you.
Morning. May it please the Court. My name is Chad Hummel. I represent Appellant Mark Arneson. Your Honors, Mr. Arneson's convictions cannot stand because of repeated constitutional violations that cannot be harmless as a matter of law. The conduct at issue in this case was actually very simple, notwithstanding the thousands of pages of briefing that Your Honors have had to review. Mr. Arneson was paid a monthly amount of $2,500 from Mr. Pelicano. The record is undisputed that he performed numerous legitimate services for Mr. Pelicano, and he reported the $2,500 per month on his federal income tax returns. He did provide DMV and criminal history information to defendant Pelicano, appellant Pelicano. And he accessed that information from LAPD and federal databases. There was no evidence in the case that Mr. Arneson participated or knew about any wiretapping, threats to individuals, injury to any individuals, changing the outcome of any proceedings that were then pending, or that he exercised any influence whatsoever on matters before the LAPD or other law enforcement. The question at trial were really two. And they go to the heart of this appeal. The question was, did Mr. Arneson believe he was being paid by Mr. Pelicano to provide DMV and criminal history information? Question one. On that question, his credibility was the central issue. Number two, was Mr. Arneson aware of the common purpose of the RICO Association in Fact enterprise that was specifically alleged in the indictment? Those were the two central theses of the defense. His credibility was critical. And, Your Honors, I submit that this record demonstrates that this government prosecution team was so determined to obliterate Mr. Arneson's credibility during the trial that it crossed the line on numerous occasions, requiring vacation of the judgment. There were two separate Garrity violations in this case, Your Honor, depriving Mr. Arneson of his Fifth Amendment rights. One was when the government, during their case in chief, called Detective Helen Lim of the LAPD. The district court called this potentially a minor Fifth Amendment violation. I would urge Your Honors to search the jurisprudence for any such thing. When the minor Fifth Amendment violation in that instance, and I'm happy to go into details if the record is not clear on this, when it impacts a defendant's credibility, a criminal defendant's credibility, it cannot be
What was it again? Just remind me.
Sure. In the government's case in chief, they called an LAPD detective, Helen Lim, who was asked about her inquiry of Defendant Arneson about his relationship
that
to Pellicano.
That was
BIA. It was one of two instances. And when she made that inquiry, IAD, you come and explain yourself. The Fifth Amendment is self-executing. There is no comment upon Mr. Arneson's decision to retire in that instance as opposed to invoking his Fifth and entering the compelled Garrity context. The second was during Mr. Arneson's cross-examination where the lead prosecutor in the case stated to the jury through his questions that Mr. Arneson had beaten an IAD inquiry because he lied. At the time that the prosecutor was asking that statement, was asking that question, the government prosecution team had within its possession a statement by Mr. Arneson to that IAD officer that had not been turned over to the defense. Notice had not been given to the defense that the government had that statement, and thus the cross-examination was improper per se. Those two violations of Garrity can never be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the government's burden here. Not only were there two Garrity violations, and I think they're adequately described in the brief, there were two separate Rule 16 violations, which this Court should analyze under an abuse of discretion standard. One was the one I just referenced, which is the government did not disclose that it had Mr. Arneson's statement to the IAD in advance of cross-examining him. The Ninth Circuit case of Balow, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, makes it abundantly clear that the issue is not whether the defense had the statement or not. Mr. Arneson surely knew he gave that statement. The issue is that the defense knew that the government had it, and they never disclosed it to defense. They never disclosed it. They never produced it or disclosed that they had it.
I thought the district court made a finding that the prosecutor didn't know that they had the statement.
The district court in the Castigar hearing made a finding that the prosecutor asking the questions was not aware of the government's possession of that tape. However, what happened there, Your Honor, was Mr. Lally, who's here, did receive the tape, did listen to it, was a member of the prosecution team, failed to disclose that he had it, and then he turned it over to a dirty team. What the dirty team is supposed to do at the U.S. Attorney's Office is make a determination of relevance or materiality to the defense, and then produce it under Rule 16. They did neither, and the testimony from the Castigar hearing is absolutely clear on that point. They did neither one. So we're left, having made a decision to call Mr. Arneson to testify on the stand with this blatant Rule 16 violation in place. And that cross-examination should not have happened. In fact, in the Castigar oral argument, in the face of a motion for mistrial, the lead prosecutor conceded that he exercised an error in judgment in asking those questions of Mr. Arneson on the stand. The second Rule 16 violation, Your Honor, occurred when Mr. Arneson's statements, letters that the government contended he signed, were not produced prior to Mr. Arneson's testimony in the case. Your Honors are well familiar with what happened in the bankruptcy context. When they were cross-examining Mr. Arneson, there was a lengthy harangue of Mr. Arneson on the stand impacting his credibility about whether or not he had filed a bankruptcy. On cross-examination, which I conducted of the government's prove-up witness, the district court stopped my cross-examination, said this person is entitled to the right to counsel, and my cross-examination was abruptly stopped. If, Your Honor, that Rule 16 material had been produced, there would have been an opportunity for a motion in limine. There would have been opportunity for none of these prejudicial impacts that occurred in the trial. But it didn't stop there. These errors were cumulative, and I urge Your Honors to read Wallace and Sanchez, Ninth Circuit decisions on cumulative error. But not only were there repeated violations of Garrity, repeated Rule 16 violations, but during Mr. Arneson's cross-examination, while the jury was still in the box, but after Judge Fisher had left the bench, the lead prosecutor approached me at the stand and threatened Mr. Arneson with remand because he believed he had just committed perjury. The comments were overheard by members of the jury. We now know not just one, but others, and we don't know how deep that conduct went. That obviously deprived Mr. Arneson of his due process rights. In closing argument, the prosecutor improperly maligned defense counsel, me, by accusing me of rehearsing the testimony of Mr. Arneson Of course, that's not evidence in the case. It constitutes both maligning defense counsel and improper vouching. And then arguing that there were 35 separate uncharged felonies to the jury. Of course, commenting on evidence that was never before the jury or the court. The final point, and then I will reserve my time for rebuttal, Your Honor, is that the failure to sever this case, the introduction of repeated, months-long evidence of the results of Mr. Pelicano's investigative services was a taint that could never be overcome. The severance should have been granted. That was more than an abuse of discretion in this context. Your Honor, I'll reserve for rebuttal, but I do want to urge the cumulative error issue, which the government did not even comment upon in its lengthy answering brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, Kevin Lally on behalf of the United States. As is evident from over 150 pretrial motions, 5 months of trial, and incredibly extensive appellate briefing, this case was hard fought by every party. But when you get through the rhetoric, you get through the argument, and you look at the record establishes that the defendants were provided the process to which they were due. The evidence used to convict them was admissible and properly admitted. The trial was fair. The verdicts were just. And the sentences were reasonable.
Could you address the California statute, the 67-68 paired statute, depending on who's being charged? I don't understand what the matter pending, how that phrase works in, or that requirement works into the circumstances of this case.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the language matter then pending exists only in Section 68. It's not an element of 67. But then as to Section 68, the California courts that have interpreted it, well, first of all, it's in the language itself. But it's a matter then pending or that could potentially come before the officer. It hasn't been interpreted as that specific officer. It's a person essentially in that position so that it could at some point in time be acted upon.
So what would be the matter pending in that that potentially might come before the LAPD?
Your Honor, there were all sorts of instances like that in this case, and we've cited a few, but I'll address them now. A lot of the work that was done by this criminal enterprise was done in ongoing criminal investigations. And so, for example, the John Gordon Jones case, where Mr. Jones was charged with various sexual assaults, that was actually being prosecuted by the L.A. District Attorney's Office, and it was an LAPD investigated case. While that case was going on, Mr. Arneson provided to Mr. Pelicano criminal history information and other information regarding 7 of the 9 charged victims, roommates, family members, other relatives, about those individuals. There are other cases. There was the Calta case, another case. Los Angeles District Attorney prosecuted, Los Angeles PD investigated case. And it was a minor victim of a sexual assault. In that case, Mr. Arneson provided to Mr. Pelicano impeachment information in the form of criminal history information on the victim, who again is a minor, her parents, her boyfriend, and others. And you know how this information gets used because in a conversation with Mr. Calta, Mr. Pelicano is explaining that what he's doing is he's looking for something that he can get under the skin of the victim so that he can approach the victim, let them know that he knows information about their past, and that at that point in time, the victim becomes unnerved and essentially wants to back out.
I understand how it can be used, but I'm not sure how that relates to how it falls within the California statute.
Well, Your Honor, so these were matters then pending before the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office.
Were they pending before Mr. Arneson?
Were those specifically? No.
Did he have any official capacity?
But the cases don't require. Those are two separate issues, and I'll address the first part initially. whether or not Arneson himself was capable of carrying out the issue isn't necessary. The Megladary case, which was reversed on venue grounds but not on the substantive principles, which are still cited to, the individual is essentially the equivalent of an appointment secretary, but didn't have the ability to carry out the particular appointments for which he received the bribes. The court said it doesn't matter. He's in a position where someone who is similarly situated could, and in that circumstance, it's covered by the case. But we can go beyond that, because in this particular case, Mr. Arneson claimed to have been investigating the John Gordon Jones case. He claims that he investigated, that he conducted an investigation at Pelicano's request to determine whether or not the victims were party girls, whether or not they were prostitutes, people that he could have prosecuted. The Aaron Finn matter, Mr. Arneson had a long story about how he officially investigated Aaron. Aaron Finn was supposed to be a high-end prostitute, and that in his position as a vice squad member, that the runs for Finn were actually legitimate law enforcement work that he did in the course of his duties. Paul Rusconi, another a male hustler who was a Pelicano investigative agency target. Mr. Arneson said that he personally invested that case because Mr. Rusconi was a hustler. These were all disproven, but Arneson claimed to have been investigating. Official capacity, a slightly separate aspect of the statute. Now, the concept of official capacity. For 5 years, Mr. Pelicano paid Mr. Arneson $190,000 in monthly checks of $2,500. He supplemented that by cash. He did it for one purpose. He found Arneson because Arneson was an LAPD officer. It was exclusively by Arneson's position as an LAPD officer that Arneson had access to the NCIC and the CLET, the CLETS databases. It was, these databases are exclusive, were created by mandate of the government. And they consist of information that has been compiled, government records of compelled interactions with the citizens of this country. And that the way to protect that information is to essentially put a lockbox on it. And they have statutes and restrictions that preclude access, preclude use, and preclude dissemination to people other than law enforcement officers in the official course of their duties. Pelicano couldn't get this information, and in fact, he repeatedly told his clients that fact, that this was information that he could only get from a law enforcement officer. And that is the sole reason he retained Arneson, and it's the only manner in which he could have obtained this information. Now, Arneson and Pelicano are saying that, well, this is a misuse of government resource. It's anything but.
Well, it is a misuse of government resource.
It is, but
otherwise, you don't have any kind of
but
case.
Not in,
so.
But it is not an incidental misuse.
But what makes it official capacity?
Because he was.
I mean, the distinction drawn is that it's one thing to be influenced in what, okay, here I'm a judge. And I take it if I am paid $10,000 and I take it to influence my decision in a given case, then that's classic bribery. But suppose I'm given $10,000 to go look in another judge's file on a case where I'm not sitting to find out who's going to win because somebody really wants to know that, and I hand that information out. Is that official capacity? I'm trying to propose really a legal question here, not a factual question. What they are alleged and convicted to have done is bad. The question is it bribery under the California statute?
And the way that the California courts have interpreted official capacity is, does it belong to the office and is it intended to be official? Now, Arneson will say that because he testified that he knew that he was serving a different master, he was serving Pelicano rather than the LAPD, that he can't be convicted of bribery. But
no, I don't think that's the argument. The argument is he didn't have an official role where he got the information. He was just using his access to the computer to get something.
But he only has access. This is a far different situation than the use of a police car or the other circumstances they cite. The only reason that this the only reason that he is able to access it is because he is a police officer. It does, the ability to do so doesn't exist outside of that particular circumstance. The information exists only in a law enforcement protected circumstance. It's the equivalent of raiding an evidence locker. The NCI system is essentially an evidence locker. It has information, confidential information that the government has stored and protects in a manner such that it isn't available to the public except in particular situations. Pelicano paid Arneson to go steal that information for him. That's a bribe. And in terms of how the California and the courts have identified it, they cite the Lips case. A better recitation of the particular standard is actually in the Longo case. And in the Longo case, the court makes reference to the fact is, does the matter come before an officer in the general scope of their duties? Is this something that they would do in the general scope of their duties? The answer is yes. And then in the process of obtaining that, is the officer essentially, sorry, I just want to make sure that I get it right, but are they putting it off as if they are arguing in their capacity? And that, in fact, is what Arneson was doing. And I'm sorry, the language was from the case is, does it fall within the general scope of the duties of the officer, and is he purporting to act in his official capacity? Well, every time that Arneson went into the police station, he went into a restricted area where he, as a police officer, could only go. He went to a computer that he, as a police officer, could only access. He put in passcodes that were given to him only because he was a police officer. He was, when he accessed NCIC, it's not enough just to go put the regular passcodes in. You have to put in additional passwords telling what is the official business that you're doing. He knew those passcodes, and he put them in because he was a police officer. And he then took that information, which he knew, he admitted, he knew to be violations of the law, and he provided them to Pelicano. That is bribery. With unless your honors have additional questions, I'll move on to honest services. With respect to the honest services issue, it is a quid pro quo bribery. The facts of the payment and the provision of the information, not in dispute. Quid pro quo bribery, and so the question is, does it come, was it a valid honest services charge under Skilling? Would submit the answer is yes. So then you get to the second question, and have the defendants met their obligations under prong three of plain error review to show that a rational jury would not have convicted based on the evidence that was presented at trial, and they haven't. Based on the Wilkes-Pelsman line of cases, we have independent bribery findings that this court can use, doesn't have to go any farther than that, can use to affirm all of the honest services wire fraud charges that are before the court. And in connection with that, I just want to highlight, as I indicated, there was no dispute as to what the general purpose of the two charges were. In fact, Arneson repeatedly referred to it as the linchpin. The linchpin of both counts was the same factual setting. And so when you have the jury's beyond the guilt findings as to the bribery racketeering acts, then you can transfer them to the honest services counts. At that point, you have 10 racketeering acts of bribery found as to both of the defendants, Arneson and Pelicano, and then you have 46 additional ones for Pelicano, 44 for Arneson. You are light years beyond the number of racketeering acts that you need to uphold the sentence of RICO. And even two of those as to any of the defendants is enough to hold the RICO conspiracy convictions as to the others. But if you were not to use the bribery racketeering acts, again, for all the reasons for which the jury's verdict was returned on the bribery counts, the evidence was overwhelming from the point of indictment, how it was charged, how the honest services charges included the bribery, specific references to bribery, through the introduction of the trial evidence, through argument. The evidence is overwhelming that the honest services counts were supported by bribery and that the jury would so find. So then moving on to some of the additional answers or some additional issues raised by counsel, just so Your Honors know, I will address the misconduct issues, and then Mr. Klein will address the computer fraud issues. So addressing those, I'll start with a fact that I need to correct in the record, which is Mr. Arneson's counsel stated that I had listened to the recording of Mr. Arneson. That is not what the record shows. It's not true. What happened was we got a series of recordings, and it's all laid out. You have the transcripts. But they didn't have identifiers on them that essentially sort of figure out what they were. And we had already been assured that there was no information that contained compelled statements by the attorney at the city attorney's office who produced that information to us. So we're attempting to figure out what this is.
Well, you know, what did you think they were based on what the city attorney told you or however they were identified when they came to you?
It came to us in the middle of trial had started, and so it was a Friday, Saturday. I mean, I don't remember the day, but I was in trial, and so I had a series of tapes, and I'm trying to figure out what they are, throwing them in a tape recorder, and in the process of doing so, I listened to just a matter of seconds, realized what it was, sealed it, brought it to the individual who had been part of the taint team in our office, and then he then took the matter over, confirmed his compelled statement, and that was the extent. Never heard any bit of the subject matter of that recording. That was subject to a CASCAR hearing. We held it immediately. We were all subject to questioning. Court made findings. Those findings are subject to clear error review. He hasn't even attempted to rebut them. The prosecution team did not have the subject matter of that questioning when they engaged in that line of cross-examination, which was done not by me, but by the other member of the trial team. Since I'm on that point, I'll address 2 points with respect to that particular matter. There was claimed to be a Rule 16 violation. Not true. What had happened, and we laid out in the brief, is that the city attorney's office essentially served as a messenger service for Mr. Arneson satisfying his Rule 16 violations. We had asked repeatedly for defense compliance with Rule 16, including at a time early in the trial when they used exhibits, which we didn't have. And the response was, it's at the city attorney's office, go get it. They'll give you what they gave us. And so after having been told that time and time again and after having been refused reciprocal discovery with the understanding that it would be satisfied by going to the city attorney's office, that's what we did. We went there. We got it. We got a subset of what they had because we only had a portion. We didn't have enough time to get the entire file. And so no Rule 16 violation. Bailey doesn't come into play.
Is there anything that you got from the city attorney's office that you didn't understand was already in the possession of the defense?
No, and it's addressed in the record with respect to the hearing. What the city attorney's office did was they gave us, they went to the discovery that they provided Arneson. They had it segregated. They had a copy in their files, and then they gave us a subset of that. So it was a complete subset of information in their possession, and so it was information that they had. They had for well before trial, and also knew the issues. The issue of the Shea complaint, the complaint about Arneson, wasn't, while there was obviously a separate file relating to that, the basic fact of its existence was known because it was in a separate IAD report, which we did produce in discovery, and there was no effort by the Arneson team to file any motions in limine in advance of trial to keep that information out. There was nothing there. They knew it to be something else possibly in play. With respect to the basic Garrity question, simply stated, you don't even, while no statement was used, you don't even need to get to the question because it wasn't material. The Arneson's credibility was in total tatters to the extent that it factors into the equation, and the government proved up its case long before Arneson took the stand. But to the extent that it even comes into place, on direct examination from his counsel, Arneson was forced to concede that he had written a letter, a non-compelled letter, to supervisors at the LAPD where he had lied to them regarding his direct involvement with Pelicano. He had also admitted to having defrauded the people of the LA or the people of Los Angeles for ages. On direct examination, he told a story about why he couldn't do a run because he was 30,000 feet flying back from Mexico. And then when presented with evidence that he'd actually cleared customs hours before, he claimed that he was just...
You may want to stay in front of the mic.
I'm sorry. Used to being at the district court level more. But he claimed to being facetious as opposed to untruthful. He referred to other lies that he was forced to admit as mistruths, untruths. And it went on and on and on and on and on. And so to the extent, but beyond that, the overarching evidence, the evidence of payments, the evidence recovered from Pelotano's office, the witness testimony about how he was the paid source for Pelotano, Arneson's admissions that he did it all, but for a different reason, it was overwhelming. The error, to the extent there was any, was harmless.
Mr. Lally?
Yes.
As the trial judge on this panel, as you might suspect, I've looked at this case from an evidentiary point of view and tried to get a sense as to what occurred during the trial in both trials, trial one and trial two. And sort of as a preliminary question, how do you handle 404B type of evidence in your district and in your court? Do you adhere to 404 B2, or do you have a local rule? In other words, does the defendant make a request under 404 B2, and then do you provide notice to the defendant at some point in time in terms of what sort of other acts or other crimes evidence you intend to produce or to submit to the jury?
It's a little bit of both, but as a matter of course, in our early discovery letters, we make note that the evidence we are producing is subject to that. But as a factual distinction, that the evidence that was presented here and in RICO cases such as this, the evidence wasn't 403 evidence at all, 404B evidence at all, but it was evidence to go to the enterprise. The enterprise here wasn't...
Well, no, listen, I understand your argument as it relates to the probative value of the evidence that was presented. My question to you was, well, let me be specific. Was there a request made here by defense counsel, and I've scoured the record looking for this, was there a request made by defense counsel pursuant to Rule 404 for the government to provide notice of 404B type prior crimes or bad acts evidence in this case?
Your Honor, I don't have a specific request made. To that extent, though, I'm not going to say it wasn't. I think there were plenty of discovery requests made to the extent that when we provided the discovery, the theories under which we were proceeding, we were open about it. And so, and it was our view from the start that this information wasn't 404B, but we would be introducing it. And so that's sort of how it proceeded.
Okay, well, let me follow up on this. Whether we call it 404B testimony or evidence, or whether you want to characterize it as evidence that's probative or material to the RICO claims, the record in this case is replete with evidence that was introduced, I assume sponsored by the government, that, as I look at the record in this case, did not appear to be directly related to the charges in the fifth indictment against these defendants. Let me give you some examples. And there's a lot of this. Evidence at the trial of a PIA client, Cammie Ross, charged with murdering a woman who plunged to her death from a 12th-floor balcony after a night of partying. Evidence relating to trial of another PIA client, John Gordon, who was charged with raping 9 women and then apparently was acquitted of that charge. Testimony that was initially offered and then stricken 2 days later by the trial judge that defendant Pelotano offered to have Aaron Russo murdered on behalf of a PIA client involved in litigation with Russo. It goes on and on in terms of this sort of evidence. As to defendant Nitchery, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, there was evidence offered that his former girlfriend, she testified she had forged her husband's signature transferred property in violation of court orders. She testified that the defendant, Nitchery, had coached her daughter to falsely accuse her ex-husband of sexual molestation, et cetera, et cetera. The government's position, obviously, I'm assuming, is that all of this testimony was relevant or probative of the RICO charge. Is that right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the RICO charge itself isn't just the racketeering acts. And the racketeering acts do describe obstruction of justice as one of the means through which the enterprise achieved its position. But if you go into the indictment itself, it talks about how the enterprise engaged in threats, blackmail, and other criminal conduct. That is criminal. That's paragraph 23. That the criminal conduct included obstruction of justice, paragraph 14. That it sought to enrich the members by using the illegally obtained information to subvert and corrupt the judicial process, 15B. That it used its illegal activities to strengthen its relationship with its clients and general reputation amongst new clients, 15C. The enterprise existed because it was serving a client base. A client base that was willing to pay exorbitant fees to have people engage, to essentially get the illegal access and the intro to confidential information, but to win. And that is plain in the indictment. In fact, the defendants, in a jury instruction, we reference it in the section that deals with constructive amendment, they say that the indictment was clear. It's the acquisition of the information and then the use of the information by Pelicano and the clients to achieve the client's goals. And with respect to the Haas acquittal, the evidence was such that that Pelicano used that to sell himself. When he actually was talking to George Colto, Colto was going to throw in a towel. Pelicano said, don't do it. I got this acquittal in the Haas matter, and here's how I did it. I got to know what the jury was thinking. I got to address, you know, exactly, it was inside their camp. I'm running out of time, and we do want to address the computer fraud issue, but that was all information that was directly responsive to.
Well, let me summarize then my questions on this subject, Mr. Lally. All of this type of evidence, and I didn't go through all of it in any detail, clearly I'm sure you would concede that this evidence was prejudicial, not just to Mr. Pelicano, but it was prejudicial to all of the defendants in the first trial, correct?
No. Your Honor, it has to be unfairly prejudicial. If the prejudice stems from the crime, if I kill somebody, there's prejudice inherent in the dead body and the way in which I killed somebody. But it doesn't mean that it's unfair prejudice. They ran a criminal enterprise that profited, that existed to benefit from these intractable problems, from the individuals who were in criminal charges and needed to do something to better their position. So the people that were having these horrific breakups, and they were looking to find a way to gain a wedge to beat their adversary.
So you're telling me that you don't believe any of that testimony was prejudicial individually or cumulative in terms of what was presented during the first trial? Not prejudicial at all?
Not unfairly prejudicial under 403.
Let me ask you this final question on this subject then. And, of course, this is an unfair question, Mr. Lally, because I haven't detailed every item of evidence that concerns me here. And if you want to characterize the question as unfair, you're certainly free to do so. But I think you understand what I'm looking at and what my concern is. Was any of this evidence, of this kind of evidence, necessary to prove any of the charges against any of the defendants? In other words, did the government have enough evidence to prove the charges in this case without this kind of evidence that we've been discussing?
It was absolutely necessary. We needed to provide context. This wasn't a case with two charges. We had 100 counts that we had to prove. And within the RICO count, we had almost 100 racketeering acts we had to prove. Each one of them needed context. Each one of them, we had a situation where Arneson would say that if it had anything to do with sexual assault, it was a legitimate law enforcement inquiry that he was engaged in. We needed to be able to rebut that. Each time, and that was what we were doing. And we were providing the context. We take the victims as we get them. These individuals accepted the money. This was that was the little vignettes that existed, and that's how we approached the matter. And so I do want to give at least a minute to my colleague to address the computer crime issue.
May it please the Court, Joshua Klein for the United States. I want to make 2 points about the computer fraud issues. First, Nozzle was a groundbreaking opinion in some ways, but it did not purport to answer every question about Section 1030. It left a lot open, and on this plain error review of an already discretionary decision about how to formulate the trial court's decision, how to formulate jury instructions, you end up with double deference, and the defendants cannot meet their plain error burden. Look how much more would have to happen for Nozzle to say what they want. Here, there was a condition precedent required in order for there to be a right to access. Nozzle says nothing about that. Arneson and Teresa Wright did not have the condition precedent, an inquiry, a business inquiry to make.
I understand you're trying to fit the time, but I'm going to take us over the time, because I'm not sure what you're referring to with condition precedent. What's that in English?
Let me put it this way. Arneson could access only if, by statute and regulation, not by private contract, only if he had a need to know, which means basically law enforcement investigation. And Teresa Wright said, even on her telephone call with Turner, yes, she has to have a reason to go into these records, which she testified meant a business inquiry into the customer record at the telephone company. It's like if I give you my key and I say, if my dog barks, you may use this key to go into the house and feed it.
Nassau basically says, the phone company, that the federal anti-hacking law isn't set up to enforce the phone company's restrictions on what you can get information for. Are you taking the position that if Nassau were in place today, nothing would have changed in this case?
If Nassau were in place today, or if it were raised at the trial court level, which it could have been, then this court would take a de novo review and decide what exactly Nassau, you wouldn't have to say what Nassau clearly says and plainly says, or you could extend Nozzle. So, for instance, you could extend it to the part where statutes and regulations, as in Arneson's case, restrict things. Let me say another thing about Nozzle. Nozzle says no liability where you have permission to access, but you use the information improperly. Here, the missing condition precedent means that they didn't have permission to access in the beginning.
Oh, in fact, they did. I mean, they had access to the databases in question.
But not to access these records. And at the beginning of the discussion section in Nozzle, Chief Judge Kaczynski says, for instance, if a person has permission to access the customer, to access the product list, but not the customer list entries, and then goes into the other entries, that's exceeding authorized access. So that's basically what's happening here. If you called with a phone company problem, Teresa Wright could access your record. She couldn't do it when Turner was paying her without such a condition precedent. At least Nozzle doesn't plainly bar that theory of liability. Nozzle leaves open the possibility that a person who enters false information to get access is exceeding authorized access. I know that opposing counsel has said Nozzle forecloses this theory or rejects it. It doesn't. That paragraph of Nozzle says the government wants to give a certain meaning to the word no permission so to access. We don't buy their argument in that case. Here's another way it could work, that phrase could have meaning if a person has permission to access using her own login and password, but instead she takes someone else's and enters the false information. Hey,
let me walk you back. I'm looking at Nozzle, and in summary, because you raised the issue of use, so I just want to make sure I understand your argument. We hold that exceeds authorized access in the CAFA is limited to violations on restrictions on access to information and not restrictions on its use. Now, how does your argument about use tie into that passage I just read?
We fit within that. at least we're not plainly against it, because we're not making an argument about use. We're making an argument that they did not have permission to access because they did not have permission to access these records, just like the example of the person without permission to access the product list, and they did not have permission to access without the pre-existing condition precedent that gives them the ability to access. In other words, it's a conditional access right. And they did not have permission to access where such access included and required entering the false code. Teresa Wright saying, I'm accessing this as an error, and that lets her go on to the next record, whereas that's a false code, which Nozzle leaves open as a possibility. If this were de novo review, this court would have an entirely different set of questions. But let me make another point, which is
the same. Plain error review can encompass changes in the law that occur before the appeal.
Absolutely, but you have to take the law as it stands now and ask what is plainly required under that law, not what would happen if you extended that law further or provided further gloss on it. And Henderson, steps 3 and 4 of plain error, also critical here. Henderson, the 1977 Supreme Court opinion, says, look, what the defendants are asking for is a further instruction than the ones they submitted and the court actually adopted. They want a further instruction saying, not just, you know, the court gave the element you have to access or exceed without authorization or in excess of authorization, but they say the court should have added an instruction. Here's what without authorization and in excess of authorization means. And Henderson, the 1977 Supreme Court opinion, said, a missing instruction clarifying an element. In Henderson, it was causation. There was a causation instruction, but it wasn't quite approximate causation instruction. He said that will very rarely be prejudicial where there was no objection made in the trial court. And now when you combine Henderson, the 2013 Supreme Court opinion, that said steps 3 and 4, that Henderson changed last year, the Supreme Court changed what had been this circuit's time of appeal rule for plain error. But they said don't worry about this opening the floodgates now that defendants can benefit from changes in the law since the time of their trial. The floodgates are not open because steps 3 and 4 are the gates that restrict relief. And they said, look, the defendant's failure to object is definitely pertinent on steps 3, was it prejudicial? And steps 4, certainly, did it affect the fairness and integrity of the proceedings? Your Honor, if that's true for a mere failure to object, it is all the more strongly true here, where the defendant submitted the instruction that was given on these points. They could have objected in the trial court. In fact, Mr. Gruhl represented Nozzle in the trial court, and these objections were being made in other cases, but they didn't. And so there's no plain error, no plain abuse of discretion in the district court's decision to follow the words of the statute and the model instructions. The Penal Code California 502 point is important as well, though, because that is an independent basis for affirming. And here, the government's case, I submit, is, if anything, stronger. First of all, this is the clearest case of invited error. Why? Because under United States against Kane, where the case that the defendants later tried to rely on for plain error was already on the books, and the Chrisman case that they now bring to the court was on the books before this trial, then, and the defendants submit the instruction, that's at the apex of the waiver or invited error doctrine. But the second part of that is that the defendants waive their rights to instruction on any elements of 502. They affirmatively said, we do not want an instruction on the elements. And then they read into the record the more general instruction they wanted instead. And on top of that, of course, for Penal Code 502, there's no California Supreme Court decision. Defendants are, frankly, overrepresenting the strength of the Chrisman case because it's contradicted by the published Maru decision that says targeting hackers is one purpose of the statute, but not the only purpose, and by Gilbert versus Sunnyvale, a published decision where a police officer accessed, like Chrisman, it's a disciplinary decision, a police officer accessed DMV information and did it without a real investigation and instead to tip off people about which were the FBI cars surveilling their business. And Gilbert v. Sullivan said, yes, that's a 502 violation. So this is even further away from clear error. And as far as how the
I think we have your position.
Okay.
Any questions?
There's nothing further.
May it please the Court, I'm going to use my 2 minutes to make a couple points about Nozzle. So essentially the government is proposing an exception to the Nozzle rule that would swallow the rule, this idea of a contingent precedent to access. The whole idea of access is that it involves the Nozzle, you know, differentiated between access and use, and now the government is trying to argue that, well, if we have this, if you're only allowed to access for a certain thing, if you do it for another purpose, that doesn't qualify, that qualifies as unlawful access. That is a clear misreading of Nozzle. We're not arguing for an extension of Nozzle. I'd like to talk about jury instructions. The government is suggesting that there's this double deference and is that somehow because we didn't object based on Nozzle that there's some extra kind of plain error review. But that's not the standard. Henderson is a Supreme Court case, but it didn't change the standard of plain error review. It clarified what already was the rule in this circuit, which is that an error is judged at the time of appeal. It's right in line with all of the other Supreme Court jurisprudence. And in this case, you know, we clearly satisfy the test for plain error review. We have error, it's plain as of the time of the appeal, and as I've argued in the brief, it's affected the defendant's substantial rights. In terms of invited error, the government has overstated what invited error is. Invited error requires a known relinquishment, the intentional relinquishment of a known right, and that is not what happened here under 502. You know, yes, there was not an objection. We concede that. But we satisfied plain error review. In essence, if you uphold Mr. Turner's convictions anyway, you're going to be basing RICO convictions on an interpretation of 502C, and that we don't even know is correct. And that, I would submit, is unfair. If the Court does not have further questions, I mean, I'd be happy to answer any questions about identity theft or Nozzle, but if we've exhausted that, I'm happy to keep talking, but my time is up.
Your time is up. We appreciate your argument.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, in response to your question about 404B, I, too, am not from the district of Central District of Los Angeles, of California. I served as a prosecutor, federal prosecutor, and now a defense lawyer up in the Northern District of California. And I, too, wondered what their rules were with respect to 404B. And to answer your question directly, I myself, as in the record on page 38 of my opening brief, less than 4 days or 4 or 5 days after Mr. Pelicano's initial appearance on the new indictment, I asked in a letter for all 404B material that the government intended to use at trial. I never got a response. And my comment to that is then, as Your Honor was indicating, highly prejudicial evidence came in at trial where Mr. Pelicano was not in any position to defend himself. I represented Mr. Pelicano mainly through the pretrial motion stage, and then he represented himself at trial. But during some of that stage, I had no opportunity to bring in limine motions to ferret out these type of responses. I had no opportunity to I didn't engage in the veneer or the voir dire, but the government's trial brief, which was 120-some pages long and cited as well on page 38 of my brief, had nothing that indicated what the witnesses were going to say at trial. Although over 120-some pages long, none of the information that Mr. Lally was talking about was ever indicated. So the individuals that conducted their voir dire during that process never had an opportunity to ferret out those type of prejudices that were clearly being brought in during that trial to inflame the jury. To answer a couple questions with respect to Your Honor's question about statutory or California statute 67, it too requires some sort of proceeding or opinion or act going on before the official. It's not just some sort of matter that he is dealing with, but something official taking place. And in conclusion, Your Honor, I would...
Well, what's the response to the fact that there were ongoing investigations and they were tapping into seeking to get at matters that were pending before the LAPD?
The response, Your Honor, is I couldn't do it any better than His Honor's hypothetical, and that being that it's one thing to be a judge on a matter and being paid $10,000 to decide that case in a particular way. It's another thing to be asked to go take a look what somebody else might be doing and reporting that when it's not.
I think there's a big difference between what we're doing as judges and what the LAPD as an institution is doing.
Well, but it may be a crime. Your Honor is correct. It may be a crime, but it's not the crime that the government chose to charge here, which is bribery. Because bribery, which deals with the paying someone to no longer exercise their independent decision-making, but to be influenced in a way to make a decision to as the briber wants or suggests, that's wholly different than just looking at something, getting into a resource, and providing that information. And that's what we had here, because none of those cases where this occurred, none of those searches that Mr. Arneson or Mr. Stevens conducted while employed as officers were matters pending before them as a police officer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll make several very brief points. With respect to bribery, which we have called the linchpin, the issue in the case that was being tried was whether Mr. Arneson knew that the payments or believed that the payments were for the provision of law enforcement information. You may take a dim view, and as Mr. Rule just said, it may be a crime to provide DMV and criminal history information. But that is what he did. That is all he did. He did not influence, and there's no evidence in the record that he influenced any matter before him, that he withheld an arrest, that he somehow got involved in a discretionary matter that was then pending before him. That's not bribery under the federal anti-gratuity statute, nor is it bribery under Section 68. With respect to Skilling, Your Honor, the government argued precisely the opposite in its closing argument to the jury in this case. They said we don't have to prove that there was any money involved. Honest services were violated simply because he provided the DMV information. Now the case, as Your Honor pointed out in the prejudice questions, and I'll address that to sum up, this case is entirely about use, and they've completely switched their Skilling theory. With respect to the final point about prejudice, it does highlight the issue I was raising with Your Honor about severance and 404B notice. There's no evidence that Mr. Arneson had anything whatsoever to do with the result of the Cammie Haas case or the John Gordon Jones case or the Anita Bush matter or the threat regarding Aaron Russo. Not prejudicial. The entire point of introducing that evidence was to demonstrate what happened as a result of actions in which Arneson had no knowledge and took no part. And the evidence there is undisputed. And the final point there I'll make, Your Honors, is this. There's briefing to the effect on the constructive amendment issue. There's some confusion in the government's brief, I think, about whether a defendant had to have knowledge of participants in the enterprise or of all the predicate acts that the enterprise accomplished. Here the issue is definitional. What was the association, in fact, enterprise? It was specifically spelled out in the indictment, and the trial judge in this case allowed a jury instruction that said if they prove anything substantially similar to that, that's enough. That is a constructive amendment requiring reversal. Unless Your Honors have any questions, I'm happy to.
Mr. Hummel, did you preserve the record on behalf of your client as it related to the evidence that you thought was prejudicial to your client?
Repeatedly, Your Honor. There were numerous defense counsel at the trial. We all joined in each other's objections, and on each instance, we objected to the introduction of this evidence. We did. Thank you.
We thank you. We thank all. I guess we're going to hear from the government again, so we thank the three of you for your arguments in this first segment. And we'll now move to the second segment, which involve Mr. Kashiki and Mr. Nisherly. Feel free to rearrange yourself as you see fit. Everybody squared away? You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Catherine Windsor, and I represent Abner Nisherly in this matter. Pursuant to the Court's order, I plan to address the first issue that I raised in my individual brief regarding the impact of Knoll v. Hall as it relates to jury instructions, although I'm certainly willing to answer questions about any other issue that I raised. There is a high probability in this case that the jury convicted Mr. Nisherly based on evidence of conduct that is not criminal under the statute with which he was charged. The government's theory of the case was that Mr. Nisherly was guilty because, one, he hired Pelicano to wiretap Mr. Shafir, and, two, because he listened to recordings of the wiretap calls and he translated them. In Knoll v. Hall, which came down right around the time we filed the notice of appeal, this Court held that replaying a recording of a previously intercepted phone conversation is not a violation of the statute. Most of the witnesses against Mr. Nisherly focused on just that. They testified about seeing Mr. Nisherly in the Pelicano offices with headphones on, listening to recordings. And there's really no dispute that these were recordings. He wasn't listening to the actual interceptions. What we know from Knoll v. Hall is that subsection A of the statute focuses on interception, and that's defined as actually capturing the contents of the wire as those contents proceed from the point of origin to the point of reception. And so when the government argued, you can find Mr. Nisherly guilty because he was sitting in the offices listening to these recordings, at that point, the crime was already completed, and you can't aid and abet an already completed crime. The listening is really covered under the use and disclosure provisions of the statute, which are subsections C and D. Because the jury most likely relied on the evidence that he had listened to these previously recorded phone calls, it is very likely that the jury convicted on that basis, and we know that's not a crime. The evidence of procurement was the complicated part of the analysis. The evidence came in through this witness, who was Mr. Nisherly's ex-girlfriend at the time. They had a very acrimonious breakup, apparently, because her vitriol practically rises from the pages of the transcripts. She was a problematic witness, and she was the one who testified about procurement. She said that testified about this check that she admitted came from her own account, but she claimed that that the account was controlled by Daniel Nisherly and Abner Nisherly. And then she identified a signature on the check. The check was signed Oren Navon, and she said that that was Daniel Nisherry's signature. So that was disputed at trial, and in closing argument, the government said, look, even if you don't think that Abner Nisherly hired Pelicano, you can find him guilty because he was sitting in the Pelicano offices listening to the recordings of these previously intercepted phone conversations. So that's really the crux of our argument. And I'm certainly willing to answer any questions about that, or I could sit down and see what the government has to say, since they didn't respond to this in the briefs.
Sounds like a good idea.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ben Coleman. I represent Appellant Kevin Kachikian. Mr. Kachikian was convicted on two counts. He was two wiretapping counts. One was a conspiratorial violation of Section 2511. The other was a substantive violation of Section 2512. And I want to focus on the jury instructions, which are the issues that we've raised in our individual brief. But just in response to what Judge Christensen had mentioned earlier, Mr. Kachikian wasn't even charged in the RICO. I mean, all this evidence came in, and he wasn't even charged in the RICO. The facts were undisputed that his entire involvement was that, as he admitted on the witness stand, he created the Telesleuth software and hardware for Mr. Pelicano. And his defense was, my understanding was that Mr. Pelicano, who had all these ties with law enforcement agencies and had police officers walking in and out of his office and all these commendations, that he was going to be selling what we were creating to law enforcement agencies. And there had even been presentations to the Orange County District Attorney's Office and the Ventura County Sheriff's Office. There was a logo. It had been patented and trademarked. He had a very substantial defense. And it's our position that the district court's jury instructions essentially gutted the defense. At the time of instructions, the basic dispute between the parties was that Mr. Kachikian wanted an instruction indicating that this was a specific intent crime, that he acted in bad faith, that he intended to violate the law and to commit criminal rather than innocent conduct. The government's position was, no, this is a general intent crime. You don't need to show any of that intent. As long as you created a wiretapping device, that's all you need. These were just general intent crimes. And, of course, this boils down to an issue that's always been tricky for the courts, which is, what is the mens rea for this particular statute? And in our briefs, we've set it out, and it may be a little bit long and dry, but we think you have to go all the way back through the history of the statute from the time it was initially enacted in 1968 and look at the amendments to the statute as well as the case law that's been interpreting the statute over the past several decades. When the statute was initially enacted in 1968, the mens rea that was incorporated was willfully. And the legislative history states that when Congress used the word willfully, it meant to adopt the definition in United States versus Murdoch. And Murdoch had basically said that willfully means with a bad purpose or an evil motive or an intent to violate the law. There then were several decisions that came down sort of in the 1970s and early 1980s that interpreted the wiretap statutes. And there was a little bit of a division between the courts. Some of the courts clearly held that you have to intend to violate the law to be guilty of the wiretapping statutes. Those decisions were from the Second Circuit. It included a decision by Justice Powell while he sat by designation on the Fourth Circuit. It included a decision from the Sixth Circuit. Other courts, including this court in United States versus McIntyre, agreed that there was a heightened mens rea requirement, but said that the intent was if you had an evil motive or a bad purpose. And it's our position that even if that is still the law, and the statute's been amended and we're going to discuss that, but even if that's still the law, Mr. Kachikian's entitled to a new trial because the jury instructions in this case clearly did not include a bad purpose or evil motive requirement. And in fact, at excerpts of record page 359, the district court specifically told the jury, do not consider the defendant's motive in determining whether he has a criminal intent in this case. So even assuming McIntyre is still the law, it's our position that Mr. Kachikian wins this case. What happens, though, after McIntyre is that in 1986, Congress amends the statute, and they change the word willfully to the word intentionally. And the question, obviously, is, well, what did Congress mean? And we have cited Chief Justice Rehnquist's dissenting opinion in Bartnicki, where he said, well, what Congress intended to do was actually increase the mens rea for the offense. And I believe the government is conceding that, at the very least, the word intentionally, it means the same thing as the word willfully. And this court and courts throughout the country have noted that the words intentionally, willfully are what Congress uses to specify a specific intent crime. So we believe that the law is overwhelmingly clear, and of course, as the case law has developed from the Supreme Court and this court, it's made it abundantly clear that the meaning of willfully is an intent to violate the law. The old language about a bad purpose or an evil motive, that's sort of fallen by way of the wayside. There was a Supreme Court case called Pompano which said, well, look, when we say evil motive, what we mean is an intent to violate the law. And this was the crux of Mr. Kachikian's defense to the two counts that he was convicted, was that he thought he was constructing legitimate wiretapping equipment, which was going to be sold to law enforcement agencies, and he wasn't doing anything wrong, which is certainly a very understandable defense.
So if the jury believed that defense, how in the instructions, under the instructions they were given, could they produce a conviction?
Because they were instructed not to consider his motive. They were not given any instructions that he had to intend to violate the law.
I'm not sure how not considering the motive speaks to this.
Well, they were
your motive is getting paid. I mean, that's motivation. What's the problem with that?
At ER page 360, the jury was specifically instructed the government does not have to prove that the defendant intended to violate the law. It's at ER 360. I mean, they were specifically instructed that intent to violate the law is not a requirement of proof in the case. And that's the whole problem here, which is why we cited the recent.
Well, what's the conspiracy that he participated in based on the verdict if it was not an unlawful conspiracy?
Well, we've obviously there are several answers to that question. The first is that the case law is clear that if the mens rea for the underlying offense is defective, that thereby taints the conspiracy count. We've also obviously made an argument that given these jury instructions and the fact that Mr. Kachikian testified at trial that he knew that Pelicano was recording his own phone calls, and given the instructions on the conspiracy, the jury may very well have convicted him based on his testimony that he thought that he knew that Pelicano was recording his own calls rather than he was conducting illegal wiretapping of third parties. And, of course, the jury acquitted him on all counts related to wiretapping of third parties, which strongly suggests that they did not understand the intent requirements as to the conspiracy, the 2511 count. And the government, of course, specifically argued during closing arguments that it doesn't matter what Mr. Kachikian's intent was. He made these devices. These devices are illegal. You're not allowed to make them. He's guilty. That was their closing argument. So the jury never, based on these instructions, specifically telling them you do not have to find that Mr. Kachikian intended to violate the law, the jury never made the requisite findings. They never got to really consider his defense. And the government, they haven't argued harmless error in their brief. They haven't contended that if I am correct that the error was harmless, and they've essentially conceded that. So the case law that has developed over the years has made it fairly clear. The government, basically their position at trial, and I guess it's their position on appeal, is that the word intentionally essentially means knowingly. That all you had to do was know that this is what you're doing and you're guilty. And of course, if that's what Congress intended, they would have used the word knowingly, not the word intentionally. The instructions in this case were general intent jury instructions, but Mr. Kachikian was charged with specific intent crimes, and his whole defense was his intent. And for that reason, it's our position that he was acquitted of several counts, but the two counts of conviction, both of them, have to be reversed. If there are no other questions, I'll save the remaining time.
You may.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'll begin with Joshua Klein for the United States again. I'll begin addressing Mr. Nasheri's arguments and then move on to Defendant Kachikian's. With respect to Defendant Nasheri, in fact, this case was not about whether or not Nasheri's defense was not about listening versus wiretapping. The government's evidence was that he had procured and solicited the wiretap. He was actually charged as an aider and abettor in the wiretapping, unlike most of the other defendants in most of the counts, unlike Mr. Kachikian, for instance, in the substantive counts involving Kachikian. And the theory was that he had, as Sarit Shafrir testified, he had, together with his brother, who were involved in a protracted dispute with Sarit Shafrir's husband or ex-husband, had arranged for, paid for, and solicited the ongoing wiretap.
Well, that's certainly one theory, and there was evidence that might support that theory. But is it clear that there was not also before the jury the option of concluding that he participated by listening and translating and that their verdict is based on that conduct separate from procurement?
Well, in this plain error review, and the defendants admit that this is a plain – Nesheri admits this is plain error review, you can look at the closing arguments. The government closing arguments, insofar as they address listening, said – I'm looking at GERT 7779 – said Nesheri aided in abetting the wiretap of Amit Shafrir based on evidence that he solicited the wiretap, hired Pelicano to conduct the wiretap, paid for the wiretap, and listened to the wiretap recordings while it was ongoing. So his listening, in other words, and this is also important for the statute of limitations part, which was their the other part this plays into, his listening was meant to support the continuing wiretap. Mr. Pelicano, when people hired the Pelicano Enterprise to wiretap, they did not do it to write a documentary history of past things. They did it so that they could get real-time information on their adversaries' conversations. And so the evidence was that he actually procured the wiretap and then did other things necessary to the wiretap, in this case, being effective. The defense closing at GERT 7993 through 8014 did not focus at all on the question either of listening versus versus procuring. The defense proposed three issues for the jury at 7995 to 96. None involved saying that the defendant only listened.
That's not real surprising, given that the distinction was not apparent in the law at the time, which really brings me back to the question I'm trying to pose, which is, what is it the jury's trying to decide this case? How do we know the jury didn't decide this case based on simply the listening element or the translation element?
Because there was unrebutted evidence that there was also payment and solicitation with both of the Nesheri brothers together.
Is this a harmless error argument?
It's an argument under prongs 3 and 4 of plain error, which include prejudice.
So you're accepting the proposition that listening by itself or translating by itself after the recordings were made does not constitute a violation?
With one proviso, Your Honor, that in a case, and I believe this could be such a case, where the listening is a necessary part of the interception itself, separate from use, then it could be a part. You know, this is like the getaway driver for a bank robbery, Your Honor. It's not actually taking the money from the bank, but it is actually aiding and abetting if it's immediate in time. And here, it was during the time that the evidence was that the interceptions continued in late 2000, early 2001, the entire time when Sarit Shafrir and Tarita Virtue both testified that Defendant Nesheri was coming to PIA on a regular basis and listening. So he was part of the procuring and enabling the interceptions to happen because that was the only way that the interceptions were in any way usable. This is different from Knoll, where someone totally unconnected got the recordings, right? In Knoll, it was an attorney, I believe, who received recordings that his client or someone else had recorded completely without his knowledge. But here, the recordings in the first instance were.
Well, you say he's completely separate. I mean, that presumes the truth of the procurement claim. I'm really stuck on the same question. What tells us that, as the jury was instructed, they couldn't have decided, well, we don't have to say whether he paid for it or not because he was involved in translating and so he's aiding and abetting?
Well, but that was not, I mean, if that was a part of the arguments, then you could say, and you do look at the arguments on third and fourth prong plain error, Your Honor, then you could say, well, the jury might have been going with that. But that was not. The government's argument, certainly, and the defense counter was not based on listening is enough. The defense argument was basically everyone's lying about everything, and even no one was intercepted at all, despite the fact that Sarit Shafrir had testified that.
But there was evidence of listening that was presented during the trial, was there not?
Yes, there was.
So back to Judge Clifton's question, how do we know what the jury, what evidence they relied upon in reaching their verdict?
Your Honor,
I understand what the arguments might have been, but in terms of the evidence that the jury had before them, how do we know?
Your Honor, if you don't know, then under plain error, where the defense bears the burden, then you must affirm. Now, I do want to address Defendant Kachikian's arguments as well. So Let me make the following points about this. Defendant Kachikian's arguments are also reviewed for plain error. It is not correct to say that the present arguments about mens rea were raised in the trial court with the degree of specificity that would have given the trial court even a fighting chance of knowing that he intended, that he wanted an instruction saying that he had to intend to violate the law, which is his present claim. He requested two instructions. The only mention of mistake of law was for section 2512, not touching 2511 at all, regarding his claim that surreptitious in the statute means unauthorized or unlawful, a claim the district court rightly rejected because surreptitious in the statute just means secret without the person who's intercepted knowing. His other proposal was titled mistake of fact, and it was in fact a mistake of fact request. The thrust of his argument was that he thought a certain fact existed. He thought that Pelicano intended to sell these to law enforcement. He thought that there was going to be no wiretapping going on. Not a belief that he thought that it was legal to produce wiretapping devices or that it was legal to wiretap. His memo supporting those instructions cited as authority a California jury instruction that says if the defendant, on mistake of fact, if the defendant believes in facts, that would make his act lawful. The classic case is bigamy, where someone believes his spouse is already deceased or divorced. He believes that as a fact. And his vague mentions, which are dropped here and there to specific intent, add nothing. Because if you look at what specific intent means, it's a somewhat rubbery term, but the specific intent crimes, look at Black's Law Dictionary, are crimes about intent to achieve a fact, robbery, the intent to permanently deprive someone of property. Forgery, the intent to have a person believe the forged document is authentic. You don't have to believe that it's legal. It doesn't make a difference whether you believe it's legal to deprive the person of property. It's the fact that matters. And so saying I want a specific intent instruction does not raise a mistake of law claim. Now, on Section 2511, Kachikian's proposed instruction basically said any good faith immunizes everything. Any belief that there could have been a legal purpose for anything immunizes him on all claims. That was so grossly overbroad that the court was right to reject it, even under the defendant's theory. And it is not plain that knowledge of illegality is required under the statute. In fact, that is expressly rejected by the Second, Sixth, Fifth, and First Circuits. And no Ninth Circuit establishes that view. McIntyre rejected that view under the current statute. The statutory language has changed, but it certainly did not increase the mens rea. A single justice's dissenting opinion does not create, and an offhand comment and a footnote of that, indeed, does not create a plain ruling of law. And even McIntyre's bad purpose language doesn't create plain error now, because the word willful has been removed from the statute, and commonly willful is the stronger term. In fact, the Lew decision, the recent Lew decision that the defense brought to the court's attention, makes the point in a statute that explicitly uses the term willful, the copyright infringement statute, and says, well, maybe where you see that, it's intent to violate the law. So beyond that, in any case, relief for this plain error question should be denied under the third and fourth prongs again. First of all, Kachikian's claim was not that he thought it was legal to intercept calls or to conspire to intercept calls. It was that he didn't think Pelicano was intercepting calls, and the jury rejected that. But second of all of the evidence regarding Kachikian showed knowledge of both illegality and certainly the much vaguer term bad purpose that they are now, in their reply brief, have tried to fall back on. He designed.
What do you make of the acquittals?
If you look at the. First, let me make one point. It's long been recognized that where a jury convicts on some counts and acquits on others, it may be nothing more than some form of compromise or giving the defendant an undeserved windfall. Look at Justice Holmes' opinion in the Dunn case, for instance. But second of all, here's the difference between the conspiracy count he was convicted of and the substantive wiretapping counts. The conspiracy count, the substantive counts did not mention aiding and abetting. And as a result, despite, and I know there was a general Pinkerton instruction, but it's also true that, as I think people on all sides of criminal litigation in the trial courts recognize, Pinkerton instructions, while the prosecution always asks for them, are very hard for the jury to apply, and jurors don't really go for them that much because they don't make a lot of sense intuitively, and especially if it's a general instruction as opposed to specifically targeting a very particular one of the 100-plus counts in this case. So the jury likely believed that Kachikian joined in the conspiracy, but did not directly participate in the wiretapping. But the conspiracy counts are still valid on that. And again, Kachikian, he built.
I confess I've been overwhelmed, so I'm losing track of the players and my scorecard is a mess. As I recall, Mr. Turner was also convicted of interception, was he not?
I believe that he was, yes.
Was there any evidence that he directly participated in the actual wiretapping?
I think he was, at a minimum, and I may have to defer to Mr. Lawley on some of the records here, but at a minimum, he was much closer in time to the particular wiretapping of particular victims because he was asking for the information and setting the wheels in motion for the switches to be flipped, whereas Kachikian, earlier on, was building the machines, building the software, and troubleshooting, but not flipping the switch on or off for particular people. Let me say, the instructions required as an element an agreement to commit the crime of interception as charged in counts 68 to 76. Each of those were specific non-consensual interceptions to the extent that the defendants, that Kachikian claims, well, maybe this was about the third, the consensual wiretapping, the jury simply could not have found that. That's the only object of conspiracy that's listed in the elements that the jury had to find. The other object the defendants point to, the using object, is only in the prefatory language. That was not something the jury actually found when, in actually convicting. They found instead that he did it as charged, the conspiracy was as charged in count 68 to 76, which were, from the trial evidence, certainly non-consensual. The victims came up and testified about that. And it's nonsensical to say, it would be nonsensical to say the jury thought, that Kachikian thought that Pelicano was using the intention, was using Pelicano's interceptions of himself, because there was no evidence of him doing that either. Let me turn to the 2512 issue, which is also raised by Mr. Kachikian. None of Kachikian's arguments on that hold any water either. The 2512 creates an affirmative defense, which the defendant has to set up and request the instruction on, and he didn't. There was no, the evidence, although Kachikian claims that the record was that he thought everything was being used by law enforcement or that there were numerous sales, that evidence was demolished at trial. In fact, they were unable to present any evidence of anything even convincing showing that that would have led a person to believe that this was being used for law enforcement sales. To the contrary, Kachikian was forced to admit that he had built in a number of features to this program. Encryption that if the particular agent knowing the password died, then the recordings would be lost forever, for instance, that had no conceivable use, inability to monitor certain kinds of calls. And again, as far as the motive and purpose, the evidence was that he built the program to self-destruct and overwrite when the one way law enforcement comes into it, the testimony was, is when law enforcement serves a warrant, say at a place like PIA, and unplugs the computers to present them, to preserve them, the evidence was Kachikian built into the program something that then when you plugged it back in the lab, it would start overwriting everything. That proves the bad purpose as well. If there are no further questions on this subject, then I think I will sit down.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Noel v. Hall does not hinge on whether the wiretap was ongoing or not. It really just focuses on subsection A, that that subsection A is about interception. And the facts of Noel v. Hall are a little quirky and probably won't come up again, but all of the cases cited by Noel v. Hall involve situations where the wiretap was ongoing. At the point that the call is intercepted, the crime is complete, and at that point we move to the use and disclosure provisions. And that's really what the government is arguing, that Mr. Nishari, by listening to these conversations, that he could use them in litigation, and that there was also evidence that he disclosed them to others.
Well, the government's using this as evidence to support the procurement theory. And there's a connection. So what is it? What can you point us to that tells us that the jury might have decided, separate apart from procuring, which would qualify, I think, as aiding and abetting, that his involvement was limited to the subsequent listening and translating?
Well, the procurement was the controversial part of it. I mean, there were many witnesses who testified that Mr. Nishari was in PIA listening. The office manager testified to that. Many people had seen him there listening to conversations. The procurement was this odd check, and that came in through a fairly controversial witness. It was disputed in closing argument, and it was at that point that the government said, you know, it doesn't matter whether if you find that he didn't hire Pelicano, you still convict because he was listening. So when you look at those two theories of liability, the stronger one certainly was the listening theory. And what the government's saying really goes to admissibility. I mean, yes, we're not saying that the government couldn't have introduced evidence that Nishari was listening, but the jury should have been told listening isn't a crime, and if you're going to consider that, you can only consider that as to procurement. And the only other point I wanted to make was also that Mr. Nishari was not charged in the RICO count, and so again, that the 404B evidence and 403 evidence was extremely prejudicial when he had absolutely nothing to do with all of those bad acts that were introduced.
Ms. Windsor, did the government argue the alternative theories in its closing argument?
It did. The government always said Mr. Nishari is guilty because he hired Mr. Pelicano and because he was sitting in the lab listening. They were always put together, and it's absolutely true that distinction was not on anyone's mind. I mean, really, at trial, they didn't distinguish, the defense didn't bring out that Mr. Nishari was listening, what he was listening to exactly. We knew they were intercepted calls, and it's clear that they were recordings. He was coming late at night to listen later on. But the government always used both of those theories together in their argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to address some substantive issues and then go to the standard of review. The government just said that Mr. Kachikian's defense was demolished. Well, he was acquitted on 9 of the 11 counts in the case. They then say, oh, well, those 9 counts, he didn't aid and abet. The jury probably found that he didn't aid and abet the wiretapping. And then the court, obviously, the obvious question is, well, they were given a Pinkerton instruction. And then their answer is, well, juries don't really like Pinkerton instructions. So when the government wants the court to find that the jury follows the instructions that they're given and follows the law, and we should presume that juries follow the law, that's the argument they make. Now their argument is, well, no, they don't really follow the law. They don't follow the instructions they're given. What's clearly going on here is a jury has rejected the fact that Mr. Kachikian had any knowledge, intent, even could reasonably believe that wiretapping of third parties was going on. And the problem with one of the many problems with the conspiracy count is that not only were they given deficient mens rea instructions, They also were – they were not told that Pelicano's wiretapping of his own calls is not a crime. And Mr. Kachikian admitted on cross-examination – the government made a big deal of this – that Mr. Kachikian knew that Pelicano was recording his own calls using Telesleuth Jr. And that's the essential problem in this case. There was deficient mens rea instructions, and there was the possibility that the jury returned a verdict on a theory that is invalid. And the government can get up here and say, well, they just disregarded Pinkerton. They didn't think about that. But this court has to presume that the jury follows the law as instructed to them. On the standard of review.
Kachikian never – were you counsel?
I was not trial counsel.
Yeah, so Kachikian's counsel didn't proffer mens rea.
He did, and that's what I want to get to is the standard of review. The government's argument was both at the same time Mr. Kachikian's proposal was way too broad and it wasn't specific enough. I guess he had to be in some magic bubble. The instruction that he proposed on page 244 was that defendant Kevin Kachikian actually believed, even if mistakenly, that the felon Pelicano intended to market the Telesleuth software and related hardware components to law enforcement is a complete defense to all of the charges, because Mr. Kachikian would not possess the requisite knowledge and intent to be convicted of these offenses. That was the instruction he proposed. He submitted a memorandum of law.
On its face, that's sort of a non-starter to me, because it says he may have believed Mr. Pelicano was going to market it, and he also knew that Mr. Pelicano was using it for all sorts of nefarious things. So just to say that you know that he's going to market it to law enforcement, that's a complete defense. Yeah, okay, I just stopped
so
right there.
Maybe that language is broad, but this is first saying that it's giving the court the notice that we believe we have an intent defense. Then you have to read this in conjunction with his memorandum of law that he submitted, where he repeatedly argued that all the offenses were specific intent crimes. He repeatedly argued that a good faith is a defense, that if he did not believe he was engaging in criminal conduct, that's a defense to the charges. And we've cited the Pineda-Doval case. The Pineda-Doval case makes it clear that this is good enough. I mean, the judge was on notice that Mr. Kachikian wanted instructions to convey the fact that if he had an innocent intent, if he was acting in good faith and did not believe that he was engaging in criminal conduct, that that was a defense. The government got up and said, nope, that's not a defense. These are general intent crimes. It's not a defense. The issue was joined. The government misled the district court, and now they want to come back and say it's Mr. Kachikian's fault. Well, the government specifically opposed the arguments and the instructions that Mr. Kachikian was given. And under Pineda-Doval, this is sufficient. We can make separate arguments, raise new cases on appeal. The question is, was the general issue raised before the court? And it was.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both appellants' counsel for your argument. Give time for everyone to get settled in.
I think we shoveled nicely, Your Honor. And I must say, counsel on all sides have been very courteous to us. We're most appreciative, even though we're here at the tail end of a hard day. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Seth Huffstedler, appearing for your last appellant on this matter. We would like, despite the fact that the numbers come out small, we'd like to divide our time between me and Mr. Marmoleski, who's in our office, of course. And I would take 4 minutes, if that appears to be satisfactory. He will have the same, and we would relieve two for rebuttal. And in the course of that, we decided, there are many issues here. We don't have to tell you that. You've had a look at them. And obviously, we can't deal with all of them in the time that we are dealing with. So we tried to select two items that we thought would fit within the time frame.
Can I just interrupt a second?
Certainly.
However you've done it, would you address the dismissal of the juror?
Certainly. There are two that we thought would fit within the four-minute slot. One of them is the Zola matter, and I'll deal with that. Mr. Marmoleski will deal with the dismissal of the juror.
Okay, so
that we'll have those two issues, and we'll do our best to make them clear in the time that we have. I'll deal with the Zola matter. And with the Zola matter, Your Honor, a little background is important, two sentences. Zolan case itself in the Supreme Court was a government win. Prior to the time there was the Zolan case, there was no way that you could have an in-camera review of claimed privileged materials. And so the government succeeded in getting the Supreme Court to lay down a procedure whereby if you have claimed privileged material and there is a claim that there's a crime-fraud exception, it's those two things. With those available, there's a procedure, but they set out a two-step procedure how you can persuade the court to do that. And that's what was initially not followed here. Now, it was followed originally. Prior to the time that there was an indictment and that it was clear that that Mr. Christensen was a target, the government filed a motion to get a determination of crime fraud in connection with another matter. And at that time, there was no, the duty judge was Judge King, and you've probably seen that. But the government told Judge King about the Zolan case and tried to go forward with that procedure. And Judge King wrote a long opinion dealing with the Zolan case and how it applied, ending up getting the other party in to participate in this proceeding, which, of course, didn't happen in this case. And so he wrote an opinion, a long opinion, and the opinion was November. The order was filed on October 24 of 05 by Judge King, treating Zolan and what had occurred. And the applications for it came with these same prior counsel, prosecution officers, and they told him all about Zolan, and they had it. Now, after October 24 order, on November 28, 1 month and 4 days following Mr. Judge King's order, the prosecution presented its then motion to the then duty judge, who turned out to be Judge Fisher, and gave her all of the recordings that had been made with a few exceptions. The others were also added on later on with identical motions for some additional orders. And so in the end, I think there were some 38 running in maybe 5 hours of a hearing. All of them given to her, never a mention of Zolan, and clearly by judges, by lawyers who understood that Zolan required that the judge could not be given the privileged material. The judge was given all of that privileged material, and she read it. She said so. It's in the record. So that's the first bad mistake that was clearly recognized, and now everybody admits it. The government admits it. The judge admitted it. That, as they said, the government, as Judge Fisher said, the government used the wrong procedure.
You're through your 4 minutes, so let me try to focus on something in particular, which is, okay, Judge Fisher acknowledges there's a problem here, and then she proceeds to reconsider.
Absolutely.
What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, she had spent all of the time reading this, or listening or reading it. It's not clear.
Yeah, but if it came up in appeal, as she observed, we'd remand it to the district court to do exactly what she did before the appeal.
Well,
so what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is she clearly was influenced by having all of that in her mind. And if you read her orders, you will find that she relies time and time again on that material.
Judges constantly hear evidence that they exclude.
Pardon?
Judges are constantly hearing evidence and seeing material that they preclude admission, and yet we don't say, but once you've looked, your eyes have clenched upon that paper, you can't put it out of your head. I mean, we just don't do that with judges. So.
I understand judges do that, and some of them succeed and some of them don't. After all, I was married to a judge for 20 years. I know a little bit about what judges think about something.
I hope you're still married.
I'm still married to that judge. She's no longer a judge. Well, all right. Let me drop to the bottom line, because 4 minutes go in a hurry when you're having fun.
Well, they're already gone, so.
All right. So let me tell you what was wrong with the judge's orders.
Okay.
She told us herself that her order was wrong under the present law and that there was no crime fraud. Remember now again, we're dealing only with crime fraud in the Zolan operation. And her order, which is, I'll give you the site first of all, so I'm sure you're able to have it and take a careful look at it. It's ER-193. And then ER-193 is her order after she does the redo, which Your Honor suggests any good judge can do, and what I would suggest in looking at this, there was some great carryover. In this, she says, when she gets down to the bottom, the last section is entitled Crime Fraud Exception. And she acknowledges the general basis. She says, crime fraud exception assures that the seal of secrecy between a lawyer and a client does not extend to communications made for the purpose of getting advice for the commission of a crime or a fraud. Test. Was the lawyer hired or retained for the purpose of aiding in the commission of a crime or a fraud? Now, if that's not there, there is no crime fraud exception to deal with. Then she says, and this is the interesting part, she cites the United States versus Bauer, Ninth Circuit case, same thing is said as Zolan's. It's clear law, and nobody really disputes that. Here, Christian's clients do not appear to be seeking advice on how to commit a crime. They do not have the test to set up the crime fraud exception. And she says that, and that's her finding. She has not now found. She has found that there was not an intent in hiring the judge to learn how to commit a crime or fraud. And then she says this, which I thought was interesting. Nevertheless, if any privilege remains, and that's a different question and that's treated in the brief, the court is confident that the crime fraud exception should be extended to vitiate it. An invitation to your honors, she says, one, this isn't, I can't do this under the present law because it doesn't fit. But this is a situation where your honors should extend the law that the Supreme Court has made and the requirements that are in Bauer and the Ninth Circuit cases. Extend the law so that this is crime fraud, even though we do not have hiring a lawyer for the purpose of committing a crime or fraud.
It's my understanding, Mr. Hofstadler, that the court found that Kerkorian was complicit. There was enough evidence to say he was not what one would call an innocent client. Let me finish my question.
Sure.
Assume, you can address whether that's well-founded, but assume that is not sustainable, that in fact Kerkorian, and I think this is what you were saying,
yes,
that if a client retains an attorney to defend him or represent him, and the attorney goes off without the client's knowledge and hires a private investigator and goes out and together, the attorney and the private investigator, illegally wiretapped to get evidence. Are you reading Judge Fisher's request for an extension to say that even if the client is innocent of all of this, gets an attorney, maybe a reputable attorney, but they go over the line, that somehow the work product and the privileged communications that are transmitted by the attorney to the private investigator back and forth, that the client has no protection after that because the attorney has, in effect, through the crime fraud exception, waived or forfeited the privilege?
Well, yeah, yes, in principal part, the attorney cannot waive the privilege. Obviously, the privilege belongs to the client. And there's no conduct of an attorney that can waive that client's privilege into whatever privilege may be, and the attorney-client privilege in particular. So I'm saying precisely what the first part of your question described. this record will not support a finding that there was a crime fraud exception. The court acknowledges it. The court says the law is different and doesn't support it. And this court should extend the law into an area where it is not now extended in order to make it possible to sustain that finding of crime fraud. Now, since, as Your Honor points out, I'm well over my 4 minutes that I started, I'll ask Mr. Sobieski to deal with the jury number seven.
Well, we do want to hear about that issue, so we'll give him a few more minutes.
Your Honor, let me just add one more point on whether or not Mr. Krikorian was complicit. Mr. Krikorian was a witness at the trial. There were questions asked that would invade the attorney-client privilege, and Judge Fischer sustained those objections. So I think the record is clear that she did not find that it applied as to Mr. Krikorian. Let me talk now about the question Judge Fischer asked about, and that is the removal of the juror. The Ninth Circuit law in Symington is clear that if there's a reasonable possibility that the request for discharge stems from doubts about the sufficiency of the evidence, the judge has only two alternatives, either declare a mistrial or send them back to deliberate. She does not have a third alternative to go and cross-examine jurors or ask leading questions to determine what they were talking about during the deliberations, and there isn't a single case that supports the type of cross-examination that the judge conducted here. The notes on their face show that there was a disagreement concerning whether or not the government had proven its case.
Let me back you up a little bit.
Okay.
This is a troublesome issue, and I'm just trying to put myself in the position that the district court found herself. I've read this transcript, seen how it all played out. The jury gets the case after these instructions, and I guess within an hour or so, they send a note out that suggests that there's a juror who Judge Fischer concluded, and that was the premise of the questioning, was unwilling to follow the law, and in fact, at the beginning, they thought three jurors were subscribing to that position because of confusion about the notes. Counsel are obviously in good faith trying to figure out what to do about this, but they have an obstructionist juror. Let's assume that that's what Judge Fischer was intending to ferret out, whether there was someone who, from the get-go, was not going to follow the law, because that was the first admonition, if you will, implicit, when they called the jury back. And she read, and with everybody's agreement, instruction number one, which essentially said you must follow the law. They go back in, and relatively shortly thereafter, they get the notes quoting juror number seven. After a lot of questioning of the jurors to find out what the notes' content meant in terms of what did the notes conveying, and she was pretty careful to say, I don't want you to talk about that was the omission. I don't want to talk about deliberations. Did you record what this juror said? Are you paraphrasing, so on and so forth? And they call a juror 11, who is a picked by, I think, your client.
That's correct.
11. So at the end, she concludes that juror number seven was lying. That is my reading of the transcript is that was a strong motivator for her decision, and it was an explicit motivator for her to discharge the juror. So you have a situation where you've gone through the trial, you instructed the jury, and the judge believes, after hearing the evidence as developed, that it doesn't go to the deliberative process in terms of whether there's a disagreement on the evidence, but that this juror lied to her when he denied knowing about the notes, and that he lied by denying talking about taxes and so on and so forth, when five jurors are saying, yes, he did. What is are you saying that Symington, which the judge firmly had in mind, Symington says the only option then at that point is to declare a mistrial and forfeit all of those efforts when they haven't, in the judge's mind, even gotten down to deliberations there in terms of the merits? You're saying that the rule of Symington is the judge is confronted with dismissing on a mistrial or has to send them back to try again?
The short answer is absolutely. The judge should never have been asking any questions of the jurors. And on the record of the notes themselves.
Where is the rule that they can't find out? I mean, what case stands for the proposition that a judge, let's suppose that this fellow declared, I'm a tax protester to the jury, and I am not going to find out, I'm not going to find this defendant guilty. I don't care what the law says. You're saying that there's no remedy for that, or it's just a mistrial.
If there is a clear record that, an unambiguous record, that there is no possibility or no reasonable possibility that the request for the discharge stems from a disagreement about the merits, then if a juror comes in there and says, I would never convict anybody.
No, he lies about it. He denies it.
But that's not what we have here, first of all. We have from the notes themselves, as Judge Fischer acknowledged the first afternoon, and that's before they go to do research over the evening, she acknowledges that the notes show that that there's a disagreement on the merits. She says, with respect to the comment, witness never tell the truth, I think that's a matter relating to deliberations and the merits of the case. She says, with respect to the third note, the case is a joke, no one died, and other comments, I think those could be construed as comments on the evidence or the weaknesses of the government's case. She has a note from the jury foreman that says he won't talk about the evidence or the law. You know, he's anti-government. And at the same time, you've got notes showing that he's talking about the evidence. And so right there, there's a reasonable possibility that the request for discharge stems from a disagreement on the merits. When you get into, and I might add that the following morning, before the jury gets there, Judge Fischer has already concluded that based on those notes, juror number 7 had lied during voir dire when he had not raised his hand to a bunch of general questions about whether or not every member of the jury would follow the law. So she's already coming into her decision to ask questions with a predetermination that I've got a rogue juror here that has lied.
She's coming in with that predetermination if her understanding of the notes is correct. That is, he's been quoted by the other jurors as saying wiretapping shouldn't be illegal, and so I'm not going to convict for that. And that's the impression left. Well, that's classic jury nullification. I don't care what the law is. I'm not going to convict because I don't think that should be the law.
Okay. But what the cases say is if it's possibly jury nullification, but there's also a reasonable possibility that it stems from a disagreement about the merits.
What's it? If it stems, what stems?
What's going on in the jury room.
Well, see, that's what we got impetus in two kinds. We've got the district court's impetus. We got whatever it is that's motivating the other juries to start sending out these notes. And one of the things that's just bizarre about this case is that it takes place right at the beginning of deliberation in an enormously long, what was it, 20-day type trial.
Right.
And I'm not a trial judge like Judge Christensen. I've watched a whole lot of trials. I was a trial lawyer. You can barely get them to clear their throats in the first hour, and suddenly you got a wave of notes coming out about this juror number 7. I have a hard time from that context concluding that they're motivated because they think this guy's going to hold out. what do they know about his views yet except what he's expressed? And what they're quoting are an expression of things that sound like nullification. Well, so how is it I'm supposed to infer from that the judge comes in with a predetermined notion that this guy's going to be a holdout and I've got to get rid of him?
No, what I said is she come in with a predetermined notion, which she says unambiguously. She says that it's clear that he lied during voir dire.
If he has the attitude that wiretapping shouldn't be a crime, so I won't convict for that. And if, in fact, he had that attitude, isn't it the case that he lied during voir dire?
Well, but there's no basis to conclude that at the time of voir dire he had any idea what the instructions on the law were going to be, much less that he had formed a decision that I'm not going to follow the law. I would ask the Court to take a look at the Thomas opinion. It's one of the two D.C. Circuit cases that form the predicate for the Ninth Circuit's decision in Symington. And in Thomas, there's a discussion about the tension between a possible jury nullification and a possible disagreement on the merits of the case. And what the D.C. Circuit says in Thomas, it says, a presiding judge faced with anything but unambiguous evidence that a juror refuses to apply the law as instructed can't investigate the alleged nullification. And the evidence was certainly not unambiguous on the issue of whether or not there was any disagreement.
Mr. Marmolevsky, in terms of the colloquy that occurred between the lower court trial judge and juror number 7, when all of this was happening, and I would agree with Judge Clifton, this is really a bizarre situation. In fact, the implication or suggestion was maybe they'd even been talking about this case and the merits of it before they even started deliberating. But is there any indication that in that colloquy the trial judge asked any questions that would be directed to the issue of whether juror number 7 could or could not follow the law?
She never asked that question at all. And yet she makes a determination that he can't follow
the law. That he cannot.
Right. But she never asked that question at all. And when she makes her determination to kick him off, she doesn't discuss the standard from Symington is whether or not there was a reasonable possibility that the request for discharge related to the merits. Now, I don't think she should have asked any questions at all, but after she asked questions of juror number 7 and then the foreman who signed some of the notes, juror number 1, it's absolutely clear that juror number 7 is reviewing the evidence and he's reviewing the law. You know, he says that, you know, they cut and pasted my comments. And she says, this is Judge Fisher says, did you say something about the law that he cut and pasted? I'm trying to figure out whether you said something about the law. What I said is we base our decision on circumstantial evidence. Well, that's absolutely appropriate for a juror in a case where there was no direct evidence of a wiretap. There are no recordings of Lisa Bonder. There's no physical evidence that her phone was ever tapped. You know, basically, they have some recordings that Mr. Pelicano knows that he's saying words into a microphone, and that's the evidence. And this juror doesn't find that's enough. He asks a question, which is noted in the third note, you know, where's Ray Turner? Because Ray Turner is supposedly the link. Mr. Turner is the one in the phone company, and if Mr. Turner was involved, maybe, in fact, there was a wiretap, and he's pointing out that Turner didn't testify. Well, that's talking about the evidence, and it's talking about circumstantial evidence versus direct evidence. And so we know from him that they're talking about it. Then we get to juror number 1, the foreman. The foreman who said he was anti-government, and according to one of the declarations submitted, talking about something that happened in the courthouse, in the courtroom, not in the jury room, said that that juror number 1 referred to juror number 7 as a commie. The same juror who says he's not talking about the law or the evidence in his note, immediately when juror number 1 is questioned by Judge Fisher, can you tell me more accurately what you heard, or is that as close as you can recall? Yeah, he stated that if the federal government charges someone, they're innocent. And he won't accept, and judge says stop. So we have this truncated proceeding where if in fact we were permitted, and you are not permitted, but if we were permitted to have an open dialogue about what happened in the jury room, what we would find is that there was a discussion about the jury instructions about circumstantial evidence and direct evidence, and there was a discussion about whether or not the government had proven its case. And some of the jurors are very unhappy that here's a juror who doesn't find that the evidence is satisfactory. We know, again, from juror number 7 that the discussions were heated. He writes that the note may have been written out of anger. Several jurors say that everybody's talking all at once. And there is nothing, unfortunately, unusual after a 5 or 6 week trial when jurors have made a tremendous sacrifice of time that they get into the jury room, and when they find out that someone doesn't disagree with them, passions get inflamed and people start yelling at each other. I had a hung jury last year, and that happened right at the beginning of the jury deliberations. People are upset that everyone doesn't agree with them. They're not discussing the law and the facts as rationally and as calmly as maybe lawyers or judges would prefer that they do it. And so, again, and I thank you for letting me to go way over our limits, there's no question here that there was at least a reasonable possibility that the impetus for the jurors' discharge stemmed from a disagreement. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Joshua Klein for the United States. Let me start with the privilege issue. Judge Fisher in the trial court found in the order, as was remarked on here, that Kerkorian's, that the evidence did provide reasonable cause to believe that Kerkorian was complicit in the wiretapping scheme. Under the In re Napster case, which discusses criminal versus civil standards, that's enough in the criminal context to pierce the privilege. That's the only level of crime fraud certainty that needs to be shown. By the time any different statement came midway through the trial, right, I believe on the day that Kerkorian was going to actually testify, the recordings had already been played, and so nothing of that affected the initial decision. But in any case, even without Kerkorian's involvement, the standard was met. This circuit's law is that an attorney's behavior can waive the client's privilege, even without the client's consent. I refer to In re Pacific Pictures, 679 F3rd at 1130. In fact, this happens all the time when lawyers turn over documents, etc. And this is the majority rule, the rule of the Third Circuit case, In re Impounded case, that Judge Fisher relied on, as well as the Fourth, Fifth, Eighth, and D.C. Circuit cases that we discuss in our brief. Christensen is wrong to dismiss these as old cases. If you key cite them, you'll see they're widely followed to this day across the country. And they apply equally to attorney-client and work product privilege. In re Sealed case, the D.C. Circuit case says at page 812 that the lawyer guilt exception, basically it says these materials are both work product and attorney-client materials. We're going to discuss them as work product. And then when it says that the privilege is pierced, it's effectively piercing it as to both categories. In In re Doe, similarly, the Fourth Circuit case, they're notes from an attorney to a client. So even though they discuss it as work product, it's like the Third Circuit saying this really applies to attorney-client privilege as well. So while this circuit has not ever been confronted with the question of whether the attorney's, the guilty attorney's intent pierces the privilege, it certainly has not foreclosed that, and the precedent is very strong from other circuits because attorneys are not a special caste of superior human beings who are specially immunized. In fact, if the attorney has committed a crime, then he does not deserve the protections of the privilege. And that's if, of course, they establish the privilege at all by asserting specific privileges as to specific calls or statements, which they have never done, not below and not here, which is why the district court was absolutely correct to find that they had not met their burden of asserting privilege.
So you're saying that our circuit has held that if the, in my hypothetical, if the client is completely innocent, the attorney goes out and uses wiretapping, that waives the confidentiality of everything that the client has divulged to his his attorney?
Well, this circuit has never addressed the issue. But let me say, we're not saying everything should have been divulged. There are legions of conversations between Kerkorian and Christensen the government never sought to touch. We just want the conversations where Christensen and Pelicano, without Kerkorian involved, are hatching, implementing, and carrying out the wiretap scheme to invade, ironically, another attorney-client set of attorney-client communications, which is why Zolan and the other cases say, look, if we overextend the privilege, then we're going to shield a lot of things that do not deserve to be privileged. If there are no further questions on the privilege issue, I'd like to turn to the dismissal of juror number 7. The Symington case applies, first of all, only where the impetus for – only where it's a question of a juror being dismissed for failure to deliberate. It has not been extended to where a juror is dismissed for other reasons, such as lying to the court, et cetera. In this case
– Well, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, the standard expressed is any reasonable possibility the impetus for dismissal derived from the juror's view of the merits. If the judge happens to give a different reason, that doesn't mean that we don't go back and reason and determine, well, was the real motivation, was the impetus from the judge or, for that matter, from the other jurors derived from or motivated by the view of the merits?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, cases like Symington and, for instance, Brown arise where it is a failure of deliberation. After 5 weeks of deliberation in Brown, after 8 days of deliberation in Symington, here, an hour and 15 minutes. In any case, though, the trial court found – the trial court applied Symington, which, by the way, says it's not a no-possibility standard. The question is, are you firmly convinced – as a trial judge, that the impetus is not disagreement on the merits of the evidence, and does that meet the
reasonable possibility. What does that translate to?
Well, the case says that it's the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which trial judges apply all the time when they're doing bench trials and find a defendant guilty. And it deserves a great deal of deference because it depends, especially here, on credibility judgments.
Mr. Klein, was Mr. Marmolevsky correct when, in response to my question, when he answered that the lower court judge did not, during the colloquy that occurred between herself and juror number 7, ever ask any questions directed to the issue of whether that juror could follow the law?
She did not ask that question, and she did not need to ask that question. Here's why. First, the juror's assurance that he will render an impartial verdict is not dispositive. This court's decisions in Beard and Egbuniwe say that the trial court is who evaluates these kinds of questions. But second, the juror had been proven a liar 3 times in open court. First, the juror lied when he contradicted his own statements, so one of them must have been a lie about whether he knew about notes. Second, the juror lied when he said, I didn't say anything about taxes. 5 jurors confirmed that he had. And third, he denied saying if the government can wiretap, then he can too. And 5 jurors confirmed that he had. So once he's lied 3 times to the judge's face, why should she ask further questions? Under Egbuniwe, moreover, and this goes to a question that the court asked, just cause removal is especially warranted where the juror problem comes during a long, expensive, and extensive trial where the retrial would cause significant resource expenditure. In any case, the point is that the defendant had the right to 12 jurors who would evaluate the evidence and apply the law. They did not have the right to nullification by a single juror who maintains that the federal government is without power to enforce Congress's law. And the tax protester is the quintessential example of that. It's familiar in district courts across the country as a person who thinks whatever people say the law is, we don't have to follow it. By the way, juror number 7's affidavit still does not say he would have followed the judge's instructions. He says, I was, not that the affidavit is necessarily admissible for the defendants, but he says, I would have followed the law. well, tax protesters think they're following the law, too, some higher law that goes beyond what everyone else in the country, or here the district judge, says that the law is. Let me make a few other points. This court does not approach the issue on a blank slate. In Symington, the district judge did not make a finding that there was no reasonable cause to believe that the juror notes were because of differing views of the evidence. Here, by contrast, the court has made such a finding beyond reasonable doubt after evaluating the evidence. And the district court was in the best position to evaluate that subject. The district court was also in the best position to evaluate the credibility of juror number 7 vis-a-vis the other 5 jurors and the meaning of those notes. And the district court's findings get strong deference in this court under Decoud, under Hyatt, and under Beard. And finally, let me just say, the district court never tried to get any deliberation information from Juror 7. Juror 7 kept volunteering it, and you can tell the district courts can't even quite hear what it is he says and repeats a few things, but she's not trying to extract that information. If there are no further questions about Trial 2, let me say, these were extremely hard-fought trials and have been hard-fought appeals with every...
We've noticed there are hard-fought appeals. Keep going.
Okay. And every conceivable issue has been raised by the defense. But on review of the record, with the district court's careful consideration, the defenses turn out to be illusory, not substantial enough to meet the burdens on appeal.
Mr. Klein, I hate to be hearkening back, and I'll be very brief here. I'm back on the evidence. There was significant testimony that came in during the second trial regarding wiretapping by defendant Pelicano well before he spoke with Christensen in 2002, and which was unrelated to Christensen, Kerkorkian, or Bonder. And this testimony came in through a whole host of different individuals, Tonta Virtue, Greg Dovell, Teresa Wright, Lily Lemasters, etc., etc. You're probably sitting there along with your co-counsel saying, I wish this evidence maniac would go back to Montana. But my question is this. What was the relevance of all of that testimony that occurred, of that other wiretapping that occurred well before the events involved in the indictment against Mr. Christensen occurred?
And, Your Honor, I'm going to have to hand off this issue to Mr. Lawley.
Mr. Lawley.
Yes, Your Honor. And this is an area where the court was exceptionally on top of the circumstance. It was litigated through the motion for severance. And while Christensen got severance from the RICO case because it was only one wiretapping count versus 110 RICO counts, the court found in the order severing the matter that she was going to withhold determination as to what additional wiretapping evidence came in at trial against Christensen directly to a later time. That was brought up. It was brought up through motions in limine. And that was when the court made the order. It was Christensen. The issues were open. They were clear. He was going to advance, sort of like a, you know, the civil attorney that he was going to advance about 5 or 6 different defenses. One of the defenses was that it was an artificial deadline drawn by Christensen, not by evidence, but one of the deadlines, or one of the defenses, was that Pelicano lost the ability to wiretap after December 1st when Ray Turner left SBC, when he retired from SBC. But that wasn't it. It wasn't limited to that. It was also that the tapes were altered. It was also that, and at trial the way it played out, they didn't just challenge the timing of the wiretapping capacity and capability. They, in fact, said they challenged the capability at all. There was extensive opening argument and then questioning of witnesses about how for Pelicano to wiretap, he would either have to build a 2.5-mile trench from Bonder's house to his office, or he would need people on the frame and explaining all the different reasons why that couldn't be done. This wasn't, and so In connection with this particular evidence, the district court, as you expect the district court to do, was, you know, found or examined the issue and found in her discretion that the evidence that the government sought to present was direct rebuttal evidence to the many different defenses that Christensen was raising. And so in connection with that, there were wiretaps that showed that it in fact occurred, additional wiretapping occurred after 2002. With respect to some of the wiretapping that occurred prior to, there was an exhibit, Exhibit 101, and Judge Fisher had a wealth of information about this particular exhibit because it was an exhibit in the prior RICO case as well, to the extent that it went to the wiretapping charges. And Exhibit 101 was a list of wiretapping passphrases. It included a phrase for Lisa Bonder Omerta. And in putting context to that particular document, there were other individuals, Lisa Gores Omerta, LaViolette Omerta, Catholic Girl Reporter Omerta, which was Anita Bush, that referenced back to other instances of wiretapping that had been done. And so when Christensen was saying there wasn't a single bit of evidence anywhere in Pelicano's office that would tie him to wiretapping other than the 6.5 hours of calls that he claimed had been altered and encrypted by Pelicano for reasons that weren't clear to anybody, but that was his position, that there was absolutely no evidence in the office. And the other, that evidence of the prior wiretaps, which flowed into this particular document, showed that not to be the case. Now, this wasn't a situation where evidence was flowing in and the judge wasn't aware of it. She was, as I indicated, very aware of it. This had been a steady issue that had been before it. And as you ask of a judge, and as you expect of a trial court who is sitting there, seeing how the evidence is coming in, seeing the defenses that are being presented before the court, and analyzing 403, she said at a particular point in the trial, "We're done. I see the government has additional witnesses. They have a special agent who's going to testify further. They have they have one person who engaged in wiretapping and one person who Pelicano, in the most overt way imaginable, solicited for wiretapping. I'm not allowing those witnesses."
Mr. Lally, I understand, we all understand the concept of the court's discretion. You've answered my question.
Thank you.
I'm going to pretend that you still reserve the 2 minutes for rebuttal, but it's 2 minutes, not 20 or 12, so.
You do have a generous clock, and I really appreciate your clock. I really want to make two quick points, and I don't think I'll take my 2 minutes, but Mr. Barmolinski needs to respond to some of those things. But with respect to the privilege question, which I addressed, I would make 2 points to Your Honors. Number one, the case with respect to overcoming the privilege, the attorney-client privilege, is completely lost and decided by the judge saying that Mr. Kerkorian did not retain or hire Mr. Christensen in order to ease into a crime or a fraud. She says that. She says you have to change the law to do it. I think that's dispositive of that point. Secondly, I must tell you, I've heard some law on here that I'm certain has never been the law, isn't going to be the law, and is not the law of the Ninth Circuit. And that is that the lawyer can give up attorney-client privilege for the client. Now, it's certainly true that there is that wild hair case, the impounded case, that I'm hearing is widely cited and generally the law, and it certainly isn't. It hasn't been widely cited. It's been criticized widely by many people. And it's quite clear that in the Ninth Circuit, in the Supreme Court, and in any other jurisdiction, the lawyer cannot give up the attorney-client privilege. Now, those are the 2 points I would make, and Mr. Marmolesi will respond to those others.
Quickly, I'm sure.
I'll try to be very quick. First of all, with respect to the question that Judge Christensen asked, needless to say, the objections to all of those witnesses were repeated over and over again, that this had nothing to do with what happened in the spring of 2002. Exhibit 101, it's a stray document that is found on Mr. Pelicano's computer all the government introduced was that it was on his computer. They didn't introduce any evidence from anyone who had ever seen the document before or what it meant. And that certainly didn't give the government license. If there's a name on a piece of paper that's located on a computer, well, we'll hear 5 days of testimony relating to what those people may have experienced with Mr. Pelicano in 1999 or 2000 or 2001. It absolutely should not have come in and was highly prejudicial. With respect to a comment that Mr. Klein made with regard to a reasonable doubt, I would ask the Court to take another look at footnote 5 in Symington, where there's a discussion of whether the interrelationship between reasonable possibility and reasonable doubt. And the dissent disagreed and thought that you needed to act to show beyond a reasonable doubt that, in fact, the impetus for the juror's dismissal was a disagreement on the merits. In fact, what the Court says is the exact opposite.
I'm thrilled to hear that. I've got footnote 5 in front of me, and I'm well aware of what it says.
Okay.
Do you have any other point you must make?
He said that there's the lies about notes and taxes. Well, first of all, the fact that there's an analogy, whether people like it or not, about taxes is not a reason to discharge someone. And lastly, this sort of debate whether it was a note or notes. If I write something on a piece of paper, those are notes. If I hand you jury note number 1 and I hand you jury note number 2, those are also notes. We don't know when juror number 7 came in there and he said the notes, whether he was referring to the writing on one piece of paper or he was referring to two pieces of paper. And again, that's not a reason to discharge somebody from a jury and to deny someone the right to a decision by a unanimous jury. Thank you.
We thank both of you for your helpful arguments. We thank the government and all counsel. The case just argued is submitted. We're adjourned.